now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome. Hi, Jolene. What's the matter?
Where's the song?
What song? Well, it's going to happen. Don't worry. You scared me.
I thought maybe it was right off the top.
No, like that.
Always surprising me, Peter.
Yeah, so you've just had a little adventure running around the neighborhood trying to get our boss's dog back.
Dogs run away sometimes. And when they're on my block, I'm out there with my dog sniffing them out.
So but you're here.
We're here, and the dog's home.
Well, we're going to talk about a lot of things tonight. Big arrests by the FBI of some militia people and the healthcare stuff. All the nutty right being nuttier and nuttier. And apparently they have now a designation for what the wacky right is experiencing. It's called ODS. We'll talk about that. But, hey, you know this song, don't you? Bruce, of course, and the boss. Born in the USA, everybody knows that song. Classic rock. Classic rocker.
Yes, right. Absolutely.
Well, you know, I never like to give people I disagree with any free publicity. I mean, if people were talking about me on other stations, that happened one time. There was this right-wing talk show in Detroit a few years ago, and I tuned in, and they were talking about me, and they were just denouncing me furiously, just telling me I was an idiot, and I was a hypocrite, and I was
commie,
everything under the sun. I'm thinking, oh, this is absolutely terrific. This is terrific, because there's always got to be people that have never heard of you. Right?
Sure.
P.T. Barnum said any publicity is good publicity as long as they spell your name right.
Yes.
So anyway.
Bruce Springsteen. Yeah, born in the USA.
Yeah. So I don't want to mention the guy's name who I'm going to talk about. So some of you will know who I mean. Others of you won't know or maybe won't even care. But he's this total whack job with a blackboard. And he discovered, far right wing guy. I mean, really nuts. And he discovered that song, Born in the USA, was not a pro-American song, but really an anti-American song.
He discovered this.
That's what he that's what he was on about. And I'm thinking, wow. I mean, what I know a lot of righties just because we say born in the USA and it kind of has this anthemic beat to it.
Patriotic.
Yeah, but and it's just probably all they heard was born in the USA, born in the USA. I got to say, even being in the business, there were a lot of songs, a lot of rock songs when I found out what they were about. I thought, wow, I didn't realize that.
Pretty radical.
Yeah, or things that weren't radical. I mean, just, you know.
Oh, sure.
I thought they were about one thing and, you know, they were about something else because all you were listening to was
the chorus.
The chorus, thank you.
The hook.
The hook, yeah. And so this right-wing whack job with a blackboard, on his radio show, he read the entire lyrics, which I was thinking about doing, but he sounded so ridiculous doing it. I don't think I could do any better. But, yeah, it's about he's born down in a dead man's town. The first kick I took was when I hit the ground. And he talks about essentially getting arrested, having to go to Vietnam, as he said, sent me off to Vietnam to go and kill the yellow man. And, he says, when he got back, he wasn't treated very well with the VA. A friend of his got killed. And it was one of Bruce Springsteen's dark portraits of this country, which resonates with a lot of people and is one truth. I mean, Bruce Springsteen doesn't say everything in America is awful.
No, he doesn't.
But certainly this comment on that war and how Vietnam veterans were treated resonated with lots and lots of men from that era.
You know,
all aging now, at best, probably late 50s. 50s, but into their 60s, some even in their 70s. So
this is all he could find this week to complain about?
Right.
Okay.
Oh, I forgot to say, too. I wrote that all down, and I can't find it. Because one of the things the whack job with the blackboard says is that he's figured out that the real evil people in this country who are producing all the real, real awful things are progressives.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it's progressivism, which I thought began with a Republican, you know, which was Teddy Roosevelt, right? And the progressive era in the late 1890s and the early part of the 20th century that created all these incredible reforms via the government, because left to the market, I mean, we were getting poisoned by the kind of food we ate. The safety regulations were zip. I mean, everything under the sun. So they began to, have the government intervene to be the referee for how the market acted. Without that, we would still be working 12, 14 hours a day, kids in the factories, poisoned food, poisoned air, all of that, like that. Well, I cannot get our... Oh, no, there it is. I was just saying I cannot get our little phone screen up that lets me see everything. Oh.
I can come over and work on that.
Yeah, why don't you come over and work on it. All right. So, in any event, I wanted to say that this is Detroit's most this is only if this means anything to you. It probably shouldn't mean a thing, because what you really want to do is to judge me, judge what other people who call into 313-298-WRIF say by what we say, not by labels, not by prejudged conceptions of who people are and all that. But I say that we're the most progressive radio show in Detroit, talk show in Detroit, and we stand for peace, social justice, and economic justice. So maybe to you, you go, yeah, everybody, who's not for that? Well, the right-wing whack jobs, you say those words, and they're like, you know, going crazy. So, which is my intent. Heavy little, you got it up?
Yep.
Well, I don't know, Jolene. Jolene thinks she's fixed it. Nope. It's not active. Let me see. I think I can do one thing here. Are we on the air, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We are.
There we go.
Okay.
Okay. You know, one of the things I've said for a long time, and I didn't make this up, I read this in lots of articles, that the embassy in Baghdad was so enormous, it's the largest embassy in the world, that you could see it from the moon.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. No, it's not
true. Was that on Snopes?
No.
Okay.
Paul Pearson wrote in, formerly called in as Paul from Redford, Paul from Michigan Hemp, or Paul from DetroitLiberation.org, the guy who threw the Liberation Day event.
Yeah, I remember Paul.
Yeah, that you thankfully attended 2 years ago. He's moved to the Houston area, and he was listening to my interview with Dalia Wasfi. And I need to let you know that the city of Baghdad cannot be seen from the surfaces of the moon unaided. Thus, the embassy, 1/12 the size of Baghdad, cannot either. This is part of a common series of misunderstanding that even Carl Sagan fell for in Cosmos when he mentioned the Great Wall of China can be seen from space, which it cannot. Mm. It is like looking at a 16-meter-long strand of hair from 11 miles away. From the moon, the Earth takes up only 9% of the sky if above the horizon. See badastronomy.com to verify such impossible anomalies.
Now we know. But I know one thing that is the absolute truth, that it's a big waste of money.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, movie theaters, Starbucks, bowling alleys.
But, you know, folks, it is easy to come up with bad facts. I mean, we can argue all day about our opinions, but I do not want to be putting out bad facts. So I really count on you. I mean, there's so much out there, and there's so much bad information. It's like the Internet, it giveth and taketh away.
Yeah.
So and I have seen this, and then I thought, maybe this guy's wrong. And I Googled something like Baghdad embassy seen from moon. And I got about like 8 articles that all said that. And Paul's right. I mean, you look at the moon, what can you see? You can see some of the huge craters, the outlines of them, if you're really on a good night. Okay. Let's talk now about ODS.
What is ODS?
ODS is Obama Derangement Syndrome.
People are deranged because they're blaming Obama and becoming deranged.
Now, this was a concept developed by John Avalon. John Avalon is he's got a new book out called Wingnuts, How the Lunatic Fringe is Hijacking America. And you go to beastbooks.com, apparently, and figure that out. TheDailyBeast.com, make it. And ODS, Obama Derangement Syndrome, pathological hatred of the president posing as patriotism, he says, has infected the Republican Party. And here he says...
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, here's new data to prove it. Now, folks, 57% of Republicans... Let's go for the big one. 67% of Republicans believe that Obama is a socialist. Mm-hmm. Now, you could... You know, I'm willing to take that out of ODS. You can say that anybody who wants any expansion of government power...
Is leaning
program,
toward socialism.
Yeah, so, okay. So, I mean, he's not a socialist by any stretch of the imagination. This health plan is not socialist in the slightest. In fact, it goes the opposite way. There's more private of the mm-hmm. health plan. In a way, most of, half or a little more of healthcare in this country is socialist or socialized in the sense that it's government yes. programs of Medicare and Medicare.
Right.
And so, but here's where it really gets nuts.
Yeah, it really does.
57% of Republicans believe that Obama is a Muslim.
And so he's what they think is he's actually disguising himself
yeah.
as a Christian.
He's not really a Christian. All those churches.
What is their problem? Oh, wait, they have this syndrome.
Yeah, they have ODS,
yeah.
Obama Derangement Syndrome. 45% of Republicans agree with the birthers in their belief that Obama was, quote, not born in the United States and so is not eligible to be the president. So half of all Republicans,
wow.
the other half really must be embarrassed, I'll tell you.
I should say so.
Yeah, I mean, because 38% of Republicans say that Obama is doing many of the things that Hitler did.
We used to say that about Bush, though.
Well, that's true, though, Bush.
I know.
Now, you know what? I never said that. He wasn't, you're looking at me like I said that.
We called him a fascist.
I never called him a fascist.
We didn't?
No.
You didn't?
I said it was the most far right-wing administration that's ever been in the United States.
Okay, is it fascistic?
Yeah, I mean, these wars based on lies, this
yeah.
ultra-nationalism. I mean, there was a lot of signs of classic fascism in the Bush playbook, that's for sure. I think these teabaggers are what they call proto-fascists, sort of the, you know, stage before fascists.
Oh, okay, all right. Little baby fascists.
Baby, just getting ready to grow up. Scariest of all, 24% of Republicans say that Obama may be the Antichrist.
The Antichrist.
The Antichrist.
This is my favorite part of the poll. I mean, come on.
Let me tell you, dear friend, particularly the latter. I mean, if you think that Obama's doing many of the things that Hitler did, you don't know anything about history, and you're really dumb. If you think that he's not a citizen of the United States, you're just not paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And if the same thing, if you repeat stuff that Obama's a Muslim, you're really dumb, too. I mean, if you go out in public and say stuff like that, people are going to think you're an idiot of
yeah.
the first magnitude.
It's just so ignorant.
So my advice would be, you know, don't say anything like that. High percentage of Republicans believe that Obama is a racist, that he's anti-American, that he wants the terrorists to win. Yeah. That he wants to turn over the sovereignty of the U.S. to a one-world government.
Peter Reddy.
Yeah.
Oh, white people.
And it is all white people, too. It is. What, you know, this whole thing about the teabaggers, and then we had a guy from Flint call a few weeks ago, said, you know, these are people of every political persuasion, you know. It's Democrats, it's independents.
Right.
Man, you know, I've not you can tell I haven't kicked this cold, right?
Yeah, but you'll get warmed up.
Yeah,
we're going. But they're all crazy.
Well, it turns out that 74% of the teabaggers are Republicans. So
yes.
What we see in the teabaggers is this this militant mobilization of the far right wing of the Republican Party.
Led by Sarah Palin.
Yeah, I guess so. She was in...
She was in Arizona. Was there in Nevada?
Both.
Both, that's right. She
yeah.
was with McCain one day.
What is this, the losers' convention?
Back together again.
I would think, wow, man, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want to revisit that.
And guess what she said when she was with McCain, Peter?
What?
She used the word maverick again. She's still on it. For the sake of your state, for the sake of our country, send a maverick back to the United States Senate. Okay.
Well, here's what I hope. I hope he gets defeated in the primary and then people come to their senses and not put that, you know, there's a like a right-wing talk show host that's running against McCain in the primary.
Oh, and apparently he's doing quite well.
Yeah. Well, here's what I don't get. About 7,000 people streamed into tiny Searchlight, Nevada, a former mining town 60 miles south of Las Vegas. And this is the hometown of Nevada Senator Harry Reid, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. So they were going to have this big rally. And they brought all their American flags, don't tread on me signs, and outspoken anger towards Reid, Barack Obama, and the health care overhaul. And Sarah Palin was there as well. Pardon me, folks, so my apologies for this. Well, here's the way they characterize it. The rally has been called a conservative Woodstock. It's been called a conservative Woodstock. Now, that was a, you know, that was a generation ago. If you're probably a regular WRF listener, maybe your parents were there, or they're part of the, you know, maybe your grandparents, who knows. But here's what I know about Woodstock. 400,000 people showed up. That's like 400,000 people, and 7,000 people streamed with their RVs into Little Searchlight. Now, Woodstock wasn't very big either, so nothing to do with the size of the town. So why do these people get this enormous attention when they're really not pulling out very many people for any of this? I mean, there are TV profiles of the teabaggers. There's interviews with them.
Explain it to me, Peter.
I don't know. I mean, it's probably a good copy. I mean, they're...
Yes.
Because...
But, you know, when we lefties were protesting, now there was some good material for television, believe me.
But they didn't... yeah, we never got any press.
I know.
All right, compare that, and I've been doing this over the weeks, with what's going to happen here in Detroit on... Between June 22nd and June 26th. It's called the U.S. Social Forum. Here, talk for me. Give me the phone numbers or something.
It's, okay. Well, no, it's the U.S. Social Forum, and we mean for the whole country. It's how many thousands, tens of thousands of people, right?
We don't know how many people are going to come. I'm looking at something. This is a resolution from the Metropolitan Detroit AFL-CIO, the Detroit Area Unions. They say 30,000 social activists will converge on Detroit for the U.S. Social Forum at one of the largest gatherings of social justice activists in Michigan in many years. Am I going to make this through the program?
You are, Peter.
So, here we're talking about, and I don't know, I think the people that are putting it on, now they're saying 15,000 people may come. That's what was in Atlanta at the last social forum in 2007. Of course, you all heard about that. You saw all the reports, all the interviews with the activists.
That's right, you didn't.
Yeah.
Now, when you went to the World Social Forum, where was that?
That was in
Venezuela?
In Caracas, yeah.
Yeah. How many people were at that?
There was about 20,000 there.
20, okay.
But that was mostly all from Latin America. I mean, there was a demonstration on the first night of 100,000 people.
Yeah, yeah.
So
big stuff.
100,000. You know, again, can we go back? The tea beggars bring 7,000. We have 100,000.
So what are they going to do with this World Social Forum? People are like, what is that? Is this where all them socialists get together?
Well, it's, I don't know. I would assume that most people would be on the left. But what the hell does that mean? I mean, are you on the left if you want peace in the world and that you're willing to work for it? It doesn't mean giving up. It doesn't mean surrendering to any enemies. It doesn't mean that you make yourself vulnerable. People that want economic justice, that everyone is rewarded well for the labor that they do, to understand that we all are part of a community of labor that creates our individual communities, that we don't want in the richest country in the world to have people like we just found out, the CEO of Ford and the president of Ford, between them making about $33 million when they forced a contract.
He got a raise.
He did. Tell me about it.
And it was, paid $17.9 million in 2009, a 5% increase as the automaker posted its first profit.
That's Mulally, right?
Mulally, right.
Yeah. And on the other hand, Ford forced the UAW accepted a contract in which people are starting at $14 an hour,
yeah,
which is a grand $28,000 a year. Probably what Mulally makes in a
much shorter period of time.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
So this is all happening. And if you're in a labor union, or a lot in the Detroit area, it's a lot of churches that are committed to peace and social justice, or you have a neighborhood organization, or you're just an individual, check this out. You can go to, let me see, what's the website here? It's USSF, like in Frank, USSF 2010.org. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, are you going to let the elites in Washington and Wall Street determine your future? I know I sound like one of these teabaggers. I mean, you know, even a broken clock is right twice a day.
True.
Yeah. So that's who right now is determining our future. There's political elites and there's economic elites. And mainly the political elites are working at the behest of the economic elites. It's not that crass and corrupt. I mean, the idea that I was listening to some of these folks saying, you know, they never should have been these bailouts and, you know, the government, you know, just took our money and bailed out the people that created the problem. Well, I think that everybody in America, no matter what your politics are, feels like that, that the Wall Street criminals who gambled with our money and wrecked our economy and then got bailed out. And we, the ordinary people, paid the cost. I mean, who doesn't feel like that? But I wish somebody would tell me, we should have just let them sink. We should have let the market take over. I mean, do you really not believe all the big economists on the left, but some on the right as well, who say this could have dragged the entire world economy down, that there would have been a collapse of economic exchange? In other words, everything would have stopped. I mean, that's the worst case scenario. And it's very possible. I mean, some people are still predicting it, I got to tell you. Also, the unions as the font, if you will, of social and economic justice in this country. You got to remember, going back into the 1880s, who was it that put forth the idea that maybe we should work 8 hours a day and not 12 and 14, that put forth every thing that we almost take for granted, a five-day week, overtime, pensions, you know, safety and health rules, Social Security, all of that stuff, all came out of the unions in the period between like the 1880s and the 1950s or 60s. Then, you know, Reaganomics and what have you took over, and it's become like the 1870s, where it's the corporations that control everything, including the government. Well, I got to say that the unions at least are starting to go on the attack again. Well, they should.
That's good news.
And there's an article in the New York Times. Unions make strides as they attack banks. And there was a demonstration that I did not go to. I wanted to go last Thursday. I wonder if any of you were there. It took place at in front of the Guardian building at, what was the big bank here? Again, this was put on by the Metropolitan Detroit AFL-CIO. Bank of America, that's where it's time to pay up. And they gave their execs, it says the leaflet here, about $145 billion. Imagine that in 2009. Pay and bonuses, $145 billion. I mean, why didn't these people, between them all, get maybe like $5
million? Yeah.
Or something
especially
like that.
Especially right now. My gosh.
And now they're spending millions lobbying to kill financial reform. America's $10 million in the hole. It's time for Wall Street to pay to create the good jobs we need. Join us to take the message right to one of the biggest, baddest banks of all. And hanging out with these teabaggers, and I know virtually nobody is. I mean, they have these big rallies, these big stars. It gets pushed by the big television network, and 7,000 people come out. Come on. We never had a single TV network give us any prior publicity. And going back to Woodstock or going up to just a little while ago, we could put 1 million people in the street in New York, for instance, back at the beginning of the Iraq War.
Oh, yeah, you were there for that one.
Yeah. So we can make it happen. We can, I guess you got to decide, are you going to be part of the resistance and the renewal of this country, the renewal of this country?
And not in the way the teabaggers are talking about.
I don't even know what they want. I mean, they're conservatives, so they want to do what? Conserve everything as it is.
And throw bricks through windows and get into road rage accidents. There's some real good ones that we'll have to get into.
Tell us about the road rage.
Oh, this is a real lovely one.
Oh, hey, by the way, let's get people in here. You're listening to Night Call on WRIF with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Can you believe I'm reading this?
I think it's kind of funny after all these years.
Let me see. Yeah, I'm Peter Werby, and that's Jalene Jordan, and our numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Yeah, we're just raving.
It's not about you, about Peter and I. It's about your phone calls.
Yeah.
So, I mean, eventually.
Give us a call.
Now, Nashville, Tennessee.
But wait. Let's just reset this. What did we call that? What was that thing called again?
I can't remember, because tonight is the first I've heard of this term.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. It's something Obama.
I got it. Obama derangement syndrome. Pathological
hatred. Write that down.
Pathological hatred of the president posing as patriotism, which is what the teabaggers are all about.
Okay. Oh, they sure are.
Go ahead.
And, well, okay, this one is a real doozy. A Nashville man says he and his 10-year-old daughter were victims of road rage. There, he had a political bumper sticker. He had a Obama bumper sticker, Obama Biden. And he said around 4:30 p.m. he was driving. He said this guy, Harry Weisiger, gave him the bird and rammed into his vehicle after noticing the sticker on his car bumper.
Man.
He pointed at the back of my car. The bumper flipped me off, one-finger salute, but it didn't end there. He honked his horn for a while, and once he started driving again after a stop sign, I looked in the rearview mirror, and he bumped into the back of him, flew up behind him and bumped into the back of him, and he pushed the car toward the sidewalk, almost onto the sidewalk. Now Harry Weisiger is charged with felony reckless endangerment and, in my opinion, complete insanity.
Yeah. Well, I would suggest reading The Rage Is Not About Healthcare by Frank Rich.
This really, I mean, in about a year, this is his best article, I would say.
It's on my, you can go to nytimes.com. nytimes.com, go to the opinion section.
And it's from today's New York Times.
Yeah. You know, I've my throat has been all right all day. I was saving it for this. Maybe I'm getting upset.
Maybe you are.
Maybe I'm getting
that whole mind-body thing, Peter.
Yeah. Man, that's right. Let's see. They're talking about the passions. You know, here in Frank Rich's column, he says, those passions have spiraled ever since from Texas Governor Rick Perry's kowtowing to secessionists at a Tea Party rally in Texas to the gratuitous brandishing of assault weapons at Obama health care rallies last summer to you lie piercing the president's address to Congress last fall like an ominous shot. And, you know, the moron from South Carolina, the congressman, the Republican congressman, he was wrong. There's nothing in this bill about giving illegal immigrants health care. So you would think that this guy would have some sort of decency and say, you know, I really made a mistake in what I said, and I was so rude and what have you.
Right, Peter.
Yeah. Here, now,
did we talk? Is this about the BRICS?
This is about the blogger. This guy. These are the. Let me see it. To all modern sons of liberty, this is your time. Break their windows. Break them now. These are the words of Mike Vanderbilt, 57, a former Alabama militiaman who took his blog urging people who oppose the health care overhaul to throw bricks through the windows of Democratic Party offices.
And they did.
And they did. So if you wish to send a message that Pelosi and her party cannot fail to hear, break their windows. And then he would break them. Break them with slingshots. Break them with baseball bats. And because of this bill that was, and then they were shattered by bricks, the local Democratic Party offices and district offices of House Democrats. Now, here is the most interesting thing of all, I think. By the way,
this is good.
Vanderbilt, who lives in the Birmingham, Alabama suburb of Pinson, described himself as a Christian libertarian. He said he has long been a gun rights advocate. Gives gun rights advocates a bad name. Vanderbilt said he once worked as a warehouse manager, but now lives. You ready? You know what I'm going to say, right? He now lives on. You know what I'm going to say, right?
What is it,
right.
Peter?
He lives on government disability checks.
Oh, ding, ding, ding. And he's bitching about the government. So why don't they just take that away? Then what will he do?
He said he receives $1,300 a month because of congestive heart failure, diabetes, and hypertension. Dude, let me give you a suggestion.
Yeah. Chill out.
Calm down. Take an anger management course and thank your government that they are paying you $1,300 a month. I mean, all of these people, a lot of these teabaggers are older, right?
Yeah.
And they're getting Medicare.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're getting Social Security.
It's like biting the hand that feeds them.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things that's interesting in Frank Rich's column, The Rage Is Not About Healthcare, it's also on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. He says, well, a couple of things. He says, where did I just see that? How curious that a mob fond of likening President Obama to Hitler knows so little about history that it doesn't recognize its own small-scale mimicry of Kristallnacht, which was, I believe, in 1938 when the Nazis went on a campaign of attacking Jewish stores all around Germany and broke so many windows. So it's like Kristallnacht, right? The weapon of choice for vigilante violence at congressional office has been a brick hurled through a window so far. So these people are crazed. They're absolutely crazed. All right, we're going to take a break and be right back.
You are listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
This is attorney D. Todd Williams. Being charged with a crime is an extremely stressful and trying event. Whether a misdemeanor, a felony, or a probation violation, knowing how to proceed and who to trust is critical. The whole process can be a nightmare, but hiring the right attorney can make all the difference. If you're facing any charges, then it's time to contact me at dtoddlaw.com. I'm an aggressive and experienced attorney who will give you straight answers, sound advice, and workable solutions to your legal challenge. From misdemeanors to serious felonies to drunk driving and drug cases, I'm the attorney you want on your side. Don't make a difficult situation worse. Contact me. I know I can help. If you have an open warrant, a pending show cause, an expungement issue, or any pending criminal case that you need to address, look us up. DTodLaw.com. That's DTodLaw.com. Make your first visit to the right attorney, D. Todd Williams, at DTodLaw.com. That's DTODDLAW.com. I'm D. Todd Williams, helping you to understand and exercise your rights.
Crowbar!
Crowbar!
Sledgehammer!
Sledgehammer!
How did the Michigan Lottery do it? How did they squeeze so many cash prizes into a single $1 million Megaplay instant ticket?
Axle grease!
Axle grease!
$1 million Megaplay is jam-packed with the most $1 million prizes ever on an instant ticket.
Battering ram!
Battering ram!
It's crammed with millions and millions in total cash prizes.
Now, push!
I am pushing!
$1 million Megaplay. Put some play in your day.
My back!
My back!
You don't need to see double.
Honey, when did we get two cats?
You don't need to talk double.
I'm not saying she said you didn't say what I said. You said I'm just saying.
You don't even need a stunt double.
I'm fine.
To play $1 million Diamond Doubler, the brilliant new instant game from the Michigan Lottery. Diamond Doubler looks rich and plays rich with lots of great cash prizes. Scratch off a diamond and you could double your prize.
Oh, I see, I see.
And top prizes of $1 million.
You don't say. I'm just saying.
Instant games. Put some double play in your day.
Sounds good, sounds good.
Imagine there were no cameras, no mirrors, but reflections. We'd walk through life wondering what we looked like. Am I good looking? What shirt compliments my eyes? Now imagine there was no census. How would we know what our community looked like? Our country? How would we know who we are as a nation? Where we're beautiful? Or where we could use a little comb over? The good news? There is a census. And you've most likely received it in the mail by now. Hopefully you haven't buried it under a pile of junk, because it's much more than a piece of paper. It's a snapshot of America. It helps us know who we are, so our communities can get their fair share of funding for the things that make us better. It's 10 simple questions and takes about 10 minutes. Fill it out and mail it back. So together, we can take a long glance in the mirror and say, you're a good-looking place, America. We can't move forward until you mail it back. 2010 Census. It's in our hands. To learn more, go to 2010census.gov. Paid for by U.S. Census Bureau.
And now, a message from Mr. Subliminal.
With an HD radio, you get all your favorite radio stations and cool new ones you've never heard before. Variety is good. And there's no monthly subscription fee like you get with your cell phone, your cable, and your high speed. I can finally afford dinner out for a change. And HD radios cost as little as $50. Wow, great deal. With HD radio, there's nothing subliminal about it. Hey, I need this job.
Find out what's playing on HD radio in your area at HDradio.com. More stations, no monthly fees. HD radio, a good deal more.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Peter and Julene, this is from Call Talk, yes, at Yahoo.com. Pardon me. Do you know about this event on Wednesday, March 31st at 7 p.m. at the Life Science Building of U of D Mercy McNichols Campus? Special guest speaker, Jake DiLiberto, a former Marine who served in Afghanistan during Operation Enduring Freedom. He is the founder of Veterans for Rethinking Afghanistan. Please announce it, Sigrid. Sure, Sigrid, glad to do it. Yeah. And I hope I have it on my website calendar. If you want to go to events that begin to link you into getting off your duff and begin to take part in history, I don't know that my website calendar is the best place, but at least it's a start. It's Peter Werby, WERBE.com. Go in the left-hand column, go down a bit, and you will see that. Now, there here's one. Hey, Peter, I was thinking, wow, why does this H-A-Y, you know, not H-E-Y?
Something else.
You know, I don't even know what to say. I mean, this
First of all, it's all in caps.
Which is screaming.
Screaming, and he's really, really, really mad.
I'm not even going to read any of it, other than the last part, which says, death to all left-wing wackos. And that's what is beginning to be the real...
Well, he's making our point.
Yeah,
The beginning of the show.
About violence, Phil. About what is beginning to really corrupt the heart of this country is the kind of level of anger. And Jerry writes in, gargle with salt water. Okay. I'll see about that. Here's some really angry guys, or maybe they're not. Federal agents conducted raids over the weekend in Lenawee and Washtenaw counties related to members of the Christian militia group. The website for the Hoodery says it is preparing for the end time battles to keep the testimony of Jesus Christ alive. Other militia groups said they have nothing to do with federal raids, and like the Michigan militia, although they said we've trained with them. You know, I got to tell you, folks, this is not necessary activity. We believe that one day, this is the Hoodery says, as prophecy says, there will be an Antichrist. All Christians must know this and prepare just as Christ commanded. Christ does not need your help. I mean, if you're into that deal, end times and belief in Jesus and all that, you don't need like a semi-automatic rifle. The guy's got more power going than that.
He will take
care of the Antichrist, even though all the whack job Republicans, or I guess it's not all of them, 24% of Republicans say Obama may be the Antichrist. But those are people that suffer from Obama derangement syndrome, ODS. So, but you know what? You know, these militias, they're kind of, don't get mad at me, guys. Let me spell the whole thing out.
Are you going to try to talk about their guns, Peter?
No, not about their guns. Not about their guns. But that essentially, like these militias are sort of volunteer firemen gone wild.
Okay, you're right.
Because ultimately, it's guys getting together, you know, with guns, and, you know, they don't just go off. I mean, it's for one thing. It's like big camaraderie, big male bonding thing. And if you go to their websites, they have dinners, and they hang. And mostly what this society does is split people up. They don't, you know, everybody's sure. Individuals. And I'm beginning to see that as the black club in our neighborhood gets bigger and bigger.
Yep.
And the thing that almost motivates everyone to join our black club are not the small problems we have. People speeding down, I'm sorry, I don't mean to say it's small. The problem of people speeding down our street or, you know, an abandoned home or something like that. But people are talking about neighbors, getting to know neighbors. So, I mean, you can, particularly if you overlay it with really big stuff, we just want to be neighbors. These guys are like into the cosmic infinity, you know, the return of Jesus and Antichrist and all of that.
Yeah.
And the militias are ready to fight the one world government and all that. I mean, that's a little more supercharged than...
I guess so.
And one of the things that, having lived for a while a few years ago in a semi-rural district, is the... I want to give a tip of the hat to the volunteer fire people, because they're good guys. I guess they probably got women in it now. It's just... But one of the things... It's not, you know, a life where you simply go to work every day, blue collar, white collar, whatever, and come home and watch television and then go up and repeat the same thing. It's not very interesting. But when you have, like, a volunteer fire department, it serves an important community need.
Absolutely.
But it also allows you to get together with other people. And then they have pancake breakfast and all that. So it's one of the factors of uniting, particularly these kind of communities that are a little, you know, 30, 40 miles out from here. And you can say, well, wait a minute, we're just in it to, you know, to help, fires, put out fires. But I've never heard of a volunteer firemen, when they got the call, ever said, oh, nuts. They're like, oh, yeah, you know, turn off the television, get in the truck, put the beanie on top, you know, and
pull out the hose.
I'm all about it. It's good stuff. And one of the things that, and it's a desire to help people, because one of the things that we found in our neighborhood group, a lot of people who are very polite when we see them on the street, when we start talking to them about doing stuff or helping or putting up a sign that says slow 25, mm-hmm. they don't want to do it. They still want to be that atomized lone individual or small household.
Well, some people just don't want to hang with your neighbors.
Well, I got to tell, and I, you know, the righties will hate this, but I mean, the experience of human beings on the planet is communal. I mean, we were able to survive because of our communal nature, that we hung together as people, and the kind of rhetoric of violence and strife and hyperbole, you know. That's what tears us apart. You know, people calling people like right-wing whack. Oh, I do that.
Well, you know, Peter, that was your evil laugh. I love that laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
Craig wrote in, and first of all, counteracting Phil, who that angry, angry person. Great show. He said, it's comforting to know there's still sane, rational people on America's airways. And he really wrote in to talk about Ann Coulter because she was in Canada.
That crazed bitch from hell.
Oh, yeah, from hell.
That always calls people names.
He said, America's sociopathic sweetheart is what he called her. And he said, he's glad she's out of their country now. Next time, send Michael Moore.
She was coming to speak somewhere, I think in Ottawa. And there was going to be a demonstration. And they claimed that it wasn't safe for her. Pardon me. And you know what, though? I mean, this is another case, and I'm always talking about, that we probably gave her free publicity. I'm willing to bet 20% of the audience even knows who the hell she is.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a third. I mean, and she is like Sarah Palin, famous for being famous.
Famous for being famous and very evil.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, and she gets off by making outrageous statements. She's kind of a comic, I hate to say it.
Yeah, she kind of is.
She says she makes me laugh. I mean, Sarah Palin's just one... Like that. But I mean, Sarah Palin, the half-term governor of Alaska, famous for what? For being a loser? For being a quitter? I mean, why is she so prominent? I don't get that in the slightest.
I don't either.
But one of the things that Angry Phil said was, maybe he's right. You know, I spend too much time talking about the teabaggers.
Well, why not? It's good fun.
Yeah, but how come if they... I mean, I'm just sort of... What I'm angry about, but, you know, I'm not, like, enraged like those folks, is they get so much press time.
Oh, yeah.
TV time.
Yeah.
And they don't represent very many people.
Right.
Like, you know, if you're just tuning in, we were saying they had a rally with Sarah Palin in Nevada, 7,000 people, and they called it a conservative Woodstock. 400,000 people came to Woodstock.
And 7,000 were at this. Okay.
Yeah. And the last big anti-war demonstration I was at was in New York City a few years ago. There was 1 million people there.
You know, it's like sensationalized much. Really?
Yeah. Here's something, though. Concealed handgun permit holders have killed at least 9 law enforcement officers in addition to 142 private citizens, including 15 shooters who killed themselves since May 2007. Mm. Well, that was one of the things. I mean, somebody was saying, oh, you know, they never do anything wrong. All right. Whew. Wow, I was sitting, everybody wants to talk. Okay. Let's see here. Let's go to Mike in Port Huron. Mike, hi, you're our first caller. Welcome to the broadcast. Hey, Mike.
Handgun.
Hey, Mike. Mike, I'm putting you back on hold. Mike.
Turn down your radio.
Turn down your radio, dude, and we'll get you there. Here's Eric in Ypsilanti. Eric, hi, you're on the air.
Good evening, guys. How's it going?
It's going good.
How are you?
I'm fine. Number one, this health care bill, I am actually opposed to it. I mean, we shouldn't be forced to get health care if we can't afford it.
Wait a minute. If you can't afford it, they're going to have subsidies for it.
They'll give it to you. Most likely.
All right, but you should also choose your own health care.
You can.
Yeah.
Oh.
You absolutely can.
All right. Number two, I don't consider myself a Democrat nor a Republican.
Me neither.
Same here.
I mean, however, there are some good Democrats and some good Republicans.
Name two good Republicans. Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot, Eric.
No, it's okay.
How about Representative Boehner? The guy with the perpetual tan.
He's too far to the right.
Yeah, well, they've gotten rid of everybody.
The man with the copper skin.
Right now, in Florida, this far-right conservative governor is being challenged by a teabagger and calling this right-wing, this Governor Chris, saying he is too far left-wing. I mean, so these guys, you know.
A bunch of idiots, I know. What else? There's an opposition party to the Tea Party movement.
Oh, it's the Coffee Party.
Like, yes, the Coffee Party.
I saw this.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to join.
Yeah. anyway, I heard about that little militia group here in Michigan.
I mean, if you think these are end times, hang out. I mean, that means Jesus is coming back. The Antichrist, you know, they probably are in the 24% of Republicans who think Obama is the Antichrist. So he's here. So then Jesus comes back, wipes everybody else out except for the good people like them.
And doesn't seem very Jesus-like.
Deal done. Well, yeah. You know, I mean, you think he's going to have a flaming sword or something like that?
I don't think anything.
All right, good. thank you, Eric. Appreciate your call. Let's see.
Happening.
Let's try Mike in Port Huron again. Mike, are you with us?
Hey, there.
Hi, yeah, we're here.
All right, cool. Get a Ricola, brother.
Yeah, oh, yeah, Ricola.
Ricola.
Yeah,
Ricola. Anyway, my thing is this. Now, I was listening a couple weeks back, and you said something about there's like 1,000 billionaires in the United States, right?
Something like that. No.
Right,
there's
no,
not that many.
No, it's not even that many.
No, nowhere near that.
Maybe million. How many millionaires are there?
No.
We had
all
stats
right,
on this.
Millionaires.
Yeah.
Either way, now, couldn't they all just throw 10% of their billions or millions in a hat, like distribute it out, have somebody distribute it out to, like, you know, the employment, you know, the other problem areas?
Ike, you sound like a commie.
No, it ain't like that. I just think that if I was a billionaire, I wouldn't have a problem giving back a percentage of my billion. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It would help the United States. Is where we got the money. The billionaire got the money from there anyway. Why not give it back is what I'm saying. Give back a little bit of it because you don't need $1 billion.
No, well, a lot of these people have what? What did we learn? That the richest man in the world now has more money. Carlos Slim has $53.5 billion, up $18.5 billion in 12 months. And you're probably remembering, Mike, when I read this this sentence from this, most of the richest people on the planet have seen their fortune soar in the past year.
That's what I'm saying. Couldn't they all just kind of get together and form their own little club? They'd be heroes.
They would.
I don't. A little bit back.
I don't get it. And they could still. I mean, what?
And they would still have more than enough.
Mike, I suspect you're like me that in your life you would like at least a little bit more money, right?
Yeah,
I would too.
I'm not greedy.
No, I know. But, you know, it would be nice, maybe, I don't know, whatever. I can think of a few things that I would buy if I had another 1,000 or another 10,000 or even another, I wouldn't say another 100,000 or 100,000. But these guys, as you're saying, have everything. So it's why do they have $53.5 billion? I mean, what do they do with it? They don't do anything with it.
It's a drop in the bucket to them.
I know. And it's what you said. If all of these billionaires got together and, I don't know, if redistributing it. I mean, there's so many people in the world that it might come out to be not too much. But the kind of money that's now just impacted as kind of stored wealth, I don't know what the hell they do with it. You're right. They would be heroes. People would love them. They would sing their praises. They would name streets and cities and ballparks after them and stuff like that. I don't know. It must be, I think greed, when it gets to a certain level, is pathological. I mean, we all work because we want more money for ourselves and our families, but once it gets by like a couple, 3 million, I don't know what the hell they're thinking. All right, Mike, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Did you have something to say?
No, I didn't. Did it look like I did?
Yes.
Just listening.
313-298 WRIF is our phone number. Here's Jason in Ann Arbor. Hi, Jason.
Hi. I sort of had a question. You might remember things better than me. But for some reason, I always started off with for some reason. I feel like healthcare was one of those issues on both sides, kind of like foreign policy. And I wonder if all these Republicans are just jealous that they didn't do it. Do you think that if McCain was in, that they would be putting in their Republican version of healthcare?
Now, they actually had a little something that didn't amount to really anything. But you got to remember, these are the people that opposed Social Security, that opposed Medicare. In fact, in this Frank Rich column, pardon me, he talks about Alf Landon, who was a 1936 candidate for the Republicans who ran on the platform of repealing Social Security because they said this was socialistic. And also, a lot of the Republicans oppose Medicare, saying the same thing, that this was going to be a government takeover of health care. And to a large extent, it was a takeover of health care of our aged, of our seniors, of our elders. And not many of them complain, even the teabaggers. They're all about their Social Security and their
disability. You're right, and they benefit from it too. And sure. I know somebody who beats the system and is the same, complains about it while they get money from the government. Also, something you guys said, I heard in a little argument. I didn't make it an argument, but it was definitely not an agreement. I heard the same thing about the immigrants, and I'm wondering where this information's coming from, because the person that told me just sounded so dead set on this is how it's going to go, and I disagreed. You know, I thought, wow, that's crazy. Why
would right.
I give the immigrants free health care?
Well, you mean illegal immigrants. I mean, the people are residents, legal residents. But still, these were all started. These were purposeful disinformation campaigns to rile up the troops by the far right-wing Republicans. Sarah Palin talking about death panels and all this. They were going to decide whether your grandma lived or died.
Yeah.
And it all turned out to be BS. Pardon me. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
So you were right.
Yeah. You were right indeed. Where did I see that? Oh, yeah. Y'all writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The Coffee Party has a Facebook page, or at least it's a page of folks who are fans of the Coffee Party.
Okay, good. We'll find them.
But you can't call them, let me see, teabaggers? What would you call coffee people?
I don't know. You have to think about it.
All right. Not too much, though.
Okay.
Let's see here. Here's Edward in Lincoln Park. Edward, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter, man? Long-time listener. You know, I'm really happy that Julie has joined you in the present time. But
good.
Thank you.
I'm really upset that my brother, he was on the team that helped pull out Saddam Hussein out of the ground when he, you know, I mean, his elite team, there's only, you know, I mean, now there's four left. But the only reason he went back and did that crap, you know, I mean, to help out America, you know, I mean, was because of 9/11, number one. And because we lost our uncle in the Pentagon, and it was really, 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 really sad that they wouldn't put him in Arlington. Like, you know, I mean, my sister-in-law really wanted him to be, in Arlington with my uncle, because that's the only reason we went back to fight for America, you know what I mean? And now there's a bunch of camaraderie that's going on. We've seen a bunch of different people come from Selfridge Air Force Base. They gave him a 21-gun salute.
Wait, your brother died?
Yeah, he passed away from a drunk driver. Somebody sideswiped him last Thursday night.
Oh, man.
What?
The guy survives Iraq, and he gets taken out by a drunk driver.
Oh, man.
Yeah, ain't that?
Yeah.
No, he was there. He was there. Remember when that gentleman walked in, and he decided to convert to Islam, and he walked in to the tent blew up and killed 16 people, you know what I mean? He's really, really, really devastated me. And he said, I will not be like that. I will not be like that. You know what I mean? I don't want to leave my children home fatherless to be able to go through that crap. But the key factor is what I'm talking about.
Which is
why doesn't the military, you know what I mean, even he's not in active duty. He's not in active duty, and
wait.
Why would they? Pardon me.
I'm sort of losing the part of the train of it. But let me do this. Let me just say that we grieve with you. Your loss, and there's just been too many. All right, Edward. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Let's see here now. Where's the next caller? Here it is. Here is Daryl and Romulus. Daryl, hi. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
Okay, I want to talk about national health care. I do agree with it.
Okay.
Part of it.
Part of it.
But I don't. Part what I don't agree with is the abortion part of it.
What do you mean?
Okay, we should have to pay for the abortions of somebody going out.
Wait a minute, Daryl, you haven't been paying attention. The only way that they got this bill through is that they had Obama signed an executive order that none of these plans that were going to be supplemented by the government could be pay for any abortions.
Elective abortion.
So there's no abortion in the health care bill at all.
Okay, great. Now, the second thing is the caller before that, he could have got buried in a national cemetery.
In Arlington, yeah.
No, not Arlington. You have to have a special thing to get in Arlington, but a national cemetery, as long as he was an honorable discharge. My brother he was in the era of Vietnam era.
Yeah.
And he passed away of national causes, I'm going to say about 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
When Bush was still in office. And we didn't have the money, and we buried him at Fort Custard out here in Michigan in Battle Creek. One of the national cemeteries. They provided the plot, they provided the headstone, and they provided the vault for him to be buried in.
Well, they should. Well, they should, too. Yeah, another loss. All right, we've got to take a break, so thank you very much. And again, your loss touches all of us, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
These days, there's a lot of things we could all do to save energy.
It's Gordy, founder of ABC Warehouse and Energy Miser.
Like replacing your regular light bulbs with wooden matches.
The roof is on fire.
Or skip the stove and instead fry eggs on a hot sidewalk.
Offer valid in Arizona and Ecuador only.
Or you could just come to ABC for an amazing deal on Energy Star appliances.
Oh, so you want to be logical.
They save energy, you'll save money. It's a save situation.
Announcing the Michigan Appliance Rebate Program. Get a cash rebate from the state of Michigan when you replace your old appliance with a qualifying Energy Star rated appliance. And if you purchase it at ABC Warehouse, ABC will match the government rebate instantly to double your savings. What's more, the appliance experts at ABC will help you through the process to make sure you're getting the maximum rebate. But hurry, government funding is limited. Once the rebates are gone, they're gone. Just think of it as cash for clunkers, but for appliances. And think of the money you'll save when you purchase your appliance at ABC Warehouse, the closest thing to wholesale.
8:05 a.m. Amp Energy Juice wake-up call.
Yeah, this is Tim.
Let's get ready to amp up the morning.
Look, I don't know what this is, but I'm late for a meeting at work.
Making his way from the bed to the office.
Come on, man. I had a rough night last night.
Just when everyone thought he was down for the count.
Oh, just spilled coffee all over my shirt.
A man that refuses to let coffee or any opponent stand in his way. What do you do for a living?
I'm a junior financial planner.
Now known across the land as Little Money.
Gotta go, all right? I'm walking to a meeting.
Let's get ready to amp up for the meeting already in progress where you'll have no value whatsoever.
Hanging up now.
Consider this your wake-up call. New Amp Energy Juice. 100% Amp Energy, 100% Juice. Amp up.
Having a slow morning? Try new Amp Energy Juice, an energy drink made from 100% juice. Amp Energy Juice dials you into the thrill of anticipation where anything is possible. Wake up with Amp Energy Juice from your favorite convenience store today. Consider this your wake-up call from Amp Energy Juice.
Grow your own pot
of tomatoes.
Stealth Hydro is Michigan's number one hydroponic supply store. Located in Ypsilanti's Depot Town at 15 East Cross Street, their hydroponic kits start at just $34.95. It's easy. Stealth Grow, Stealth Bloom, and Stealth Micronutrient packets eliminate the need for measuring. Simply fill the reservoir bucket to the indicated line with water and add the required feeding packet. That's it. Beginner to experienced grower, anyone can do this.
Even you.
Stealth Hydro's friendly and experienced team is standing by to answer your questions. Before and after the sale. Just call 866-998-1916. Toll free, 866-998-1916. Or visit StealthHydro.com. Stealth Hydro also has everything you need. Kits, lights, and nutrients. Get started today. Visit StealthHydro.com.
Grow your own pot.
out of tomatoes.
Call Stealth Hydro, 866-998-1916, or visit stealthhydro.com. It's Red Wings playoff time. No fears, no excuses, no mercy. Get your Red Wings tickets for rounds 1 and 2 now. Call 800-745-3000 or go to DetroitRedWings.com. Hockey Town, no limits.
Now, a message from one of the co-founders of ADAM, the American Divorce Association for Men.
Gentlemen, for years, ADAM has been addressing men who are facing divorce. Today, we want to talk to men facing a happier, yet equally scary situation, marriage. Do you know that prenuptial agreements are valid in this state? Do you know that a prenuptial may not only protect the property you already have, but also the property you acquired during the marriage, including your entire pension? Do you know that a prenup may be used to eliminate any potential claim for alimony? Call ADAM at 248-356-ADAM and we can answer all of your questions. I've never had a divorce client who didn't wish he was smart enough to have gotten a prenup. That goes for blue-collar guys to multimillionaire business owners. Look, you buy homeowners insurance year after year to protect you from the 1 in 1,000 chance your home will burn to the ground. Don't you think a prenup is advisable to protect you from the 50% chance you may face a divorce? Call ADAM at 248-356-ADAM. That's 248-356-2326 or on the web at adamdivorcelaw.com.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much.
You cannot petition the Lord with prayer!
So says Jim Morrison.
Well, Thank you, Jim.
When Pope Benedict XVI was Archbishop of Munich and Freising, he was broadly described as a theologian, more concerned with doctrinal debates than personnel matters. That, say his defenders, helps explain why he did not keep close tabs on a pedophile priest sent to his archdiocese in 1980 and allowed to work in a parish.
I just couldn't figure that out, Peter. Yeah. I'm so glad they clarified.
Who was the other guy that they let? They kept complaining. He was at the school for deaf, the priest. He had boogered like 200 little boys, and they kept writing and saying, look at this guy is, As Archbishop, Benedict expended more energy pursuing theological dissidents than sexual predators. Already in the early 1980s, one could catch a glimpse of a future pope preoccupied with combating any movement away from church tradition. This guy who was in the Hitler Youth when he was a kid, and they always say unwillingly, but that he's a far-right winger, and he has been purging the church of anybody who was to the left, making the church as right-wing as it has been in other historical periods, because it was starting to be very liberal.
Yeah, and unfortunately not purging the church of the perpetrators.
Vatican experts say there is little evidence that Benedict spent much time investigating more than 200 cases of problem priests in the diocese, with issues including alcohol abuse, adultery, and now under the microscope, pedophilia. I mean, they have a much higher incidence of problems than most professions, I have to say.
It's true.
Yeah. So what's up there? Also in religion, at the edge of an arid foothill far outside Los Angeles, hundreds of Scientology followers live on a gated 500-acre campus and work long hours for almost no pay, reproducing the works of founder L. Ron Hubbard and creating the church's teaching and promotional materials. The church says its 5,000 so-called Sea Organization members, SEA, are religious devotees akin to monks who are exempt from wage requirements and overtime. But two lawsuits filed by two former Sea Org members, as they are known, allege the workers are little more than slave laborers forced to work 100-hour weeks for pennies and threatened with manual labor if they cause trouble. The members are Scientology's most devoted followers. They sign a billion-year pledge, vow not to have children, and live and work communally.
What? This is nutty.
Yeah, how come all these Hollywood people are into this?
Big time. The Travoltas hugely...
Tom Cruise.
I was going to say Madonna, no, but she's Kabbalah.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise.
Eric from Ypsilanti, pardon me, said there were good people in both parties. And I said, name two Republicans. And I kind of stumped them, right? But Jerry writes in the call talk, yes, at yahoo.com, William Milliken, Now, William Milliken was the governor of Michigan when, the 60s, the 70s. I was surprised that he is actually still alive. He was actually a pretty good governor. And he was pro-civil rights and environmental protection, and he endorsed John Kerry for president in 2004. Mm-hmm. Doesn't sound like a hell of a Republican, right?
Right.
And also, you know, the Detroit Riverwalk that goes from the Rensen and is eventually in May even. I'm going to go see that. It's going to be, what, in the 70s, Wednesday and Thursday?
Oh, yes.
I'm going to go check it out. They have a Milliken Park that that starts at the Brevard, what's it called, the Brevard Station or something like that, and goes on towards Belle Isle.
Oh, how about that?
So they named it after him, and apparently he was there at the dedication last fall. Okay, let's continue on. Hey, a couple open lines, 313-298-WRIF. That's our phone number. Here's Sean in Monroe. Sean, hi, it's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
How are you guys doing?
We're doing good.
If I have the time, I have three real quick points I'd like to make for you guys.
Sure, go ahead.
All right, the first one is about the religious group that got raided.
Yeah.
Why did they get raided in the first place?
Well, they said it was some firearms violation. You know, there are certain laws that you can't have certain guns and certain weaponry and all that.
All right, because I haven't heard, all the news broadcasts I've heard have been saying that they're not disclosing any information. So that was the first one. The second was earlier you said there were 9 police officers killed by CCW.
Holders.
Carriers.
Yeah.
Now, is that Michigan, or is that the whole U.S.?
No, I think it's the whole U.S.
Well, I know, but Jalene was saying something about sensationalizing, and that's kind of made it sound real bad, but that's the whole U.S. It's not really a whole lot.
Okay.
All right, and the third one was the executive order that Obama just signed.
About abortion?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
If everybody goes on YouTube, just look it up. That was one of the premises that Obama promised. His executive orders were unconstitutional, and he promises he won't sign any.
Why would the executive orders are signed all the time? I mean, he's signed tons of executive orders. Every president does.
Yes, sir. But if I promise you, if you go on YouTube and look at some of the speeches, watch some of the speeches that he was making during his campaign, he was promising not to make them because they're unconstitutional.
You sure he's not talking about
different?
You sure he's not talking about these signing statements that things would get passed and then Bush would write that he wasn't going to follow?
No, executive orders.
Okay. By the way, the Michigan militia and some of the other militias were not touched. In fact, they backed away from this group that was arrested, this Christian millenarian movement. So it wasn't just aimed at militias or people that had guns or anything like that. All right, Sean, thank you very much. I don't want to do the work right now. If somebody else wants to do it for me, I can't believe that that Obama would have said executive orders are unconstitutional. Maybe he did. I don't know. Doesn't hurt.
I kind of doubt it.
I mean, if Obama... I'm no big fan of Obama. All right. Here is DW. DW, where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm calling from Novi tonight.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good evening. Hope you're having a good evening.
Pretty good. Good. Very good.
I just saw, I was watching Headline News the other night, and they did this really interesting piece on, you know, talking about teabaggers and how the Republicans are getting upset with, you know, the use of the word. And I just thought it was interesting because they actually went back and looked at the definition, and teabagging actually, if the Republicans or the right are called teabaggers, they're actually giving the teabags to the Democrats. So as a Democrat, how do you feel? Do you like my balls across your nose or your chin?
What time is it? Okay, we can let that in. But let me tell you.
Wow.
Did he just hang up too? Oh yeah. I guess he thought that was really naughty.
So he thought that was funny.
He thought it was naughty.
He was trying to get us.
Yeah, it was naughty. Yeah, I don't. But they were the ones that initially called themselves teabaggers until people.
Well, till someone pointed it out in their organization, or, well, someone like us pointed out, hey, by the way, you might want to look it up.
Yeah, so now they just were the Tea Party.
Oh, yeah. People get really mad at us for talking about the teabaggers, don't they?
Yeah.
Very hurt by our words.
313-298-WRIF. Open lines for you. Here's Joe in Detroit. Joe, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
And Jillian?
Great, thanks.
I wanted to talk about 1980, the National Republican Convention was held here at Joe Louis Arena.
It was.
I was 13 at the time, and I was downtown at Hart Plaza. For only the third time in history, they gave away the key to the city of Detroit.
Yeah?
Anybody want to guess who got the key to the city of Detroit that year?
Abby Hoffman.
Not even.
Who?
Saddam Hussein.
Come on.
No, sir. So that year, not only were probably George Bush, Ronald Reagan, George Bush Jr. was here, probably Oliver North was here. For all we know, Manuel Noriega was here, but for sure, Saddam Hussein was here as well.
What? You know, give me a source, Joe. I don't think the guy ever left Baghdad.
Oh, absolutely. He got the key to the city of Detroit from Coleman Young. And not only that, in exchange, I think Coleman Young got the money to build the People Mover. But at the time, underneath many of the street signs for the city of Detroit, it said one of our sister cities was in Iraq.
Really? Well, you know that Saddam Hussein was a big ally of the United States during the 1980s. Reagan and then Bush Sr. gave a lot of money to him. They gave them a lot of intelligence for their war with Iran. In fact, they were real happy that they were killing each other. But Donald Rumsfeld, who, of course, was the guy that told a lot of the lies about the Iraq War, the run-up to it, and said, hey, this was going to be a cakewalk. We could really...
Yeah, in and out.
Couple of weeks, in and out. The old in and out. Yeah, but he presented Saddam Hussein with a pair of golden spurs in Baghdad as a little gift from the American government. All right, thank you very much. Okay, folks, do some work for us. Come on.
I'm looking, and my computer is so slow, but there are many sources that it's... Here we go. It's true.
It is.
This is from CBS News from 2003. Saddam Hussein donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to a Detroit church and received a key to the city more than two decades ago. Oh, that's... Okay. Soon after he became the president of Iraq. Saddam's bonds with Detroit started in 79 when the Reverend Jacob Yasso of Chaldean Sacred Heart congratulated Saddam on his presidency. In return, the church received $250,000. As far as the people mover goes, I can't confirm that.
But you know what? They persecuted the Chaldeans. Wait a minute. Did they or didn't they? Now, come on, some of you folks.
He said he was very kind to Christians. Chaldeans are, this says, a Catholic group in predominantly Muslim Iraq.
Right.
Among prominent Chaldeans is Iraq's deputy prime minister, Tariq Aziz.
Okay.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So, some of you folks know this history a little better than I do. Tell me.
Here we go. Courtesy of then-Mayor Coleman Young.
Wow. And what was the other thing? Anybody get the Obama and presidential executive orders? I'd like to hear about that, too. Okay, let's go back to our phones. Here, let's see. Here is Tommy and Warren. Hi, Tommy. You're on the air.
How you guys doing?
We're doing good.
I think, Peter, I think you might have had a traumatic experience when you were young with teabagging, right? Is that why you don't like it? Give me back that fillet of fish.
Hey,
give me that fish.
I don't know, man. Fish. I don't get that.
I don't know, Peter.
Yeah, yeah, I love it. Here's Frank in Garden City. Frank, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. When they wanted to take you off the air way back in the day after the, was it 2000? What was it? 11? 9/11.
They took me off. They never took me off.
No, they didn't.
No, they wanted to.
No, they didn't.
Who's they?
I don't know who they are.
Well, we're at a loss.
What the hell are you talking about?
What? Hello? Turn your radio all the way off.
It is off.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. But I was sitting in my car listening to you.
Yeah.
And want to take you off or something, off the air?
No.
No.
You, right? Oh, okay.
The WRIF management has always been so supportive of this
program.
One time, somebody bought this company, pardon me, before the way before the current company, and they decided this is a rock and roll station, and they were going to get rid of like Midnight Metal and my show and all that. And people had demonstrations outside of the WRF offices and signed petitions, and I was astounded. They actually put me back on.
Well, you know, they are strong believers of free speech, and you know what? They think what we're doing is important.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's important, too, but I'm not a teabagger. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. But where do you think this government's going?
Well, I think it's going in a lot of different directions. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that Obama has done that I don't agree with. And I suppose, given the... I don't know whether he could have shown more leadership in this healthcare fight. Pardon me. And gotten what we really needed in this at a minimum was a public option. In other words, something that would force the healthcare companies to have some competition and drive the price down. But where is it going? I don't know. Does it have a big agenda? Well, they just did, by the way, we're talking about single payer, and that would have been essentially what's happened now with this bill that has taken student loans out of the hands of private insurers and now essentially made it a government program that would say it's going to save hundreds of billions of dollars for our students. I mean, the outrageous rates that people are paying and what students get stuck with.
Oh, yeah, you know, and then they get out of school, they can't pay them back, and then they get seriously punished for that.
And also, next month there's going to be a new treaty signed between the U.S. and Russia to reduce nuclear arsenals. That's pretty good.
That's real good.
The Environmental Protection Agency announced it's going to overhaul drinking water regulations so that officials are going to police dozens of contaminants simultaneously and tighten rules on chemicals used by industry. That's really good.
You know what about that, Peter? You drink tap water.
I do.
And you've told me all these years that it's okay for me to drink tap water, and then I read things like this. I'm concerned.
As you get for listening to me.
That's what I get for drinking your Kool-Aid, Peter.
But get this. The new policies, which are still being drawn up, will probably force some local water systems to use more effective cleaning technologies, but may raise water rates.
It's already gone up. You know, it went up 7% last year in our community,
yeah,
Peter.
I know. But get this. It's always blackmail. So what do you want? A lot of chemicals in your water or higher prices?
Right.
Exactly.
It's just like buying organics. They're pretty expensive. And
thanks,
you want to be healthy, but you can't afford to be.
Yeah. Here is Theo. Theo's in Detroit. Hi, Theo.
Hi. Happy Sunday to both of you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I want to tell you about an article in the paper about Bill Clinton, Hillary, and Chelsea. But since you brought up the chemical thing, can I also ask you if you're familiar with sodium phosphate that was put in our water in 1994?
Wow. Right.
Yeah, sodium phosphate. Supposedly, lead clings to it, and it's supposed to reduce the amount of lead in the water. The problem with it is sodium, by any other name, is still salt, and salt
sure.
Not good for you. And I spoke with a scientist in Indiana who was saying that we could use magnesium phosphate just as easily as sodium phosphate. That would not have the same effect. The magnesium phosphate is a little more expensive, but you use less of it, so it would be a wash. Now, to Hillary, the Clinton family.
Yeah, what did they do?
Well, the mother supposedly has written a prenuptial agreement for Chelsea.
What?
Chelsea was dating Mark, I forgot his last name, as they were teenagers and time went on, they split up dating other people and now they're back together again. I guess cause his dad, I guess he might be coming out of prison now. Anyway, the mother, Hillary has written this prenuptial agreement that says, you all are sitting down, that if the new husband, commits adultery, with somebody, like a Monica Lewinsky example that her father was into, he has to pay Chelsea $10 million.
I love
it. Now, when Bill...
She's a little bit scarred.
This is Hillary's revenge.
When Bill heard about this, I guess somebody asked him what was his opinion. He said, well, you know, that can kind of make a man act right. But my question is this. Is Chelsea so pure of mind and heart and body that she might not commit adultery?
That's true. That's you're very suspect. I like it. That's funny.
All right. Thank you very much, Theo. I appreciate that little info.
Who's really totally pure of heart? Come on.
Just me.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You're right.
Yeah.
Only you.
313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Joe from Farmington Hills, we were talking about how many billionaires in the United States. He says, without attribution, but this sounds right, 370 billionaires in the U.S., 500,000 millionaires. Sarah Palin now wants $1 million per episode for her reality show, all the while she berates union workers and their wages.
Yeah, great point.
So
thank you.
I can't do the math here. 500,000 times a million. I mean, we're talking about a lot of impacted wealth here. And it's not just like these people are worth $1 billion. You've got two. I'm trying to think. The top 10 are probably worth $100 billion, more than that. So this, you have a situation where wealth impacts there's less for the rest of us, you know? I mean, why don't they pay their workers a little more money or something like that?
Do something.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Matthew in Clawson. Go ahead, Matthew. You're on the air.
Hey, I would just have to say about the war in Afghanistan, you know, the Bush days, we heard about the war. And now Obama days, we don't hear nothing.
We don't hear too much about it. He's over there now. Do you know that?
I know that, but our boys are struggling, man. I mean, come on. Give us a break, you know.
What?
You know, I mean, come on. We're Americans, man. Let's you know, go for it. You know, let's support our boys, you know.
How do you do that?
Who's not doing that? Who are you talking about?
I just want to praise. I got two nephews in the military, and one was in Afghanistan. I just say, you know, hey, let's bring the top agent about the military. You know, man, they bust their butt, you know.
Well, they do, but they shouldn't have to bust their butt. They shouldn't even be over there. I don't understand what this war is all about.
I understand that, but I think, you know, it's not in the newspapers anymore, you know, and I appreciate you guys' radio. I love it to death. I mean, I am a supporter of your radio station.
Great. Thank you.
I just thank you for my opinion, but I think we need to, like, I mean, healthcare and all that stuff, we got to look out for the soldiers.
Indeed. I agree. In fact,
when they get back, take care of them.
Take care of them, indeed. All right. Thank you very much. Here's this from Kabul. U.S. turns a blind eye to opium in Afghan town. You got to remember the evil, awful Taliban completely eradicated poppy cultivation. Now, of course, Afghanistan's the largest
exporter in the world.
The effort to win over Afghans on former Taliban turf in Marja has put American and NATO commanders in the unusual position of arguing against opium eradication, pitting them against some Afghan officials who are pushing to destroy the harvest. From General Stanley A. McChrystal on down, the military's position is clear. Quote, U.S. forces no longer eradicate, as one NATO official put it. Opium is the main livelihood of 60-70% of the farmers in Marja, which was seized from the Taliban the Taliban rebels. I don't get this. Why are they the rebels? They were the government. Then the U.S. overthrew them in a major offensive last month. American Marines occupying the area are under orders to leave the farmers' fields alone. Well, shouldn't they at least then make heroin legal in the United States? Afghan officials are divided, though some support the American position. Others, citing a constitutional ban on opium cultivation, want to plow the fields under before the harvest, which has already begun in parts of Helmand province.
Well, they're clearly trying to get along and
win the hearts and minds. All right, let's see. Here is Mike in Royal Oak. Mike, hi. You got more information about Saddam Hussein in Detroit?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify what that guy mentioned. He was partially right, but most, you know, some of his stuff was wrong. Saddam Hussein, he did give money on several occasions to Detroit, mostly for the people over here who were displaced from different, you know, wars, Middle East people. and then also to some churches. And through a roundabout way, he ended up giving some money directly to Detroit. And that is why, the Jeep Detroit and Coleman Young gave him the key to the city. But he never came here, so he was never here.
Oh.
It was kind of given to him, through a ceremony. And what they did with that money may have been for the people mover, I don't know. But he was never here. And from what I remember, I think he was at the only point that the only person that ever be given the key to the city. And since then, and I hate to relate this these two people together, but Steve Eisenman was given one a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
And made the distinction of being the only two people to be given.
Oh, my gosh. I just think that people mover part, if it's true, is so funny.
Well, yeah, when did the people mover begin? I can't even remember.
I'm trying to think. I'm not sure. I know I was growing up when it was being built. I want to guess 76 or 77.
Yeah, we used to call it.
I'm just taking a guess.
We still do call it the train to nowhere.
Really?
It's kind of fun.
It is.
Take it around.
Like a little, like being at Disneyland.
All right, Mike, thanks for the info. I don't know why this made me think of this, but Henry Ford the First received the Order of the Iron Cross from the German government in 1938. So this is Hitler's government in Detroit.
They were buds.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hitler, buds. In the bunker, Hitler had a picture of...
A photo of Henry Ford.
Yes.
And he used his Henry Ford's anti-Semitic ravings as one of the arguments for his anti-Jewish campaigns.
Wow.
And credited Henry Ford, who sent money to the Nazi party in the 1920s, with saving the party financially. So he had a lot of dues to pay. Let's see here. Here is Jeff in Marine City. Jeff, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, what's up? I only have one simple thing to say.
What?
I'm only 29 years old, and I believe I've been raped by Jennifer Granholm.
How so?
She just fucked my whole day up.
Oh, man. Duh, dude, you're out of here. Dude. You know, people... When there's a convergence there of stupid opinions. I mean, I don't got anything to say for Jennifer Granholm, particularly.
Right, sure.
But sort of blaming what happened, financially in this state on her, I don't get it.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Here's Paul in Belleville. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, Peter, I had a question. Why do we take care of the rest of the world and we don't take care of our own people?
Well, most of it isn't taking care of other people. Most of it is military aid. I mean, when we're giving Israel and Egypt and Jordan and all these other countries, Colombia, billions and billions of our tax dollars, it's mostly all going for military stuff.
Okay, my question is...
Why do we do it? I don't know, because we think, gee, we got to have all these people on our side or they'll go on... Whose side? I don't even know who. There's not like Russia anymore.
Yeah, I mean, but my question is, I don't have nothing against the Haitian people or anything, but we rushed to help them, and yet we never rebuilt New Orleans or anything else. We didn't help those our own people.
Well, we're talking Bush, and a little different. Although the United States is not given very much money. So, I mean, millions, but these days that's just a drop in the bucket. But I know what you're saying. I mean, if people had to vote on whether, I mean, let me ask you this, Paul. How much money do you want to give to the Egyptian military? Very much? I don't want to give any. Do you?
I don't want to give any.
No, neither do I. How much money do you want to give to Israel? Do you want to give any? I don't want to give any.
Oh,
How about Jordan? How about Colombia? I don't want to give any of those countries any money.
I mean, we can have our allies and stuff, but why don't we help our veterans here that are coming back from these wars that are tore all to pieces, and we're just going to put them in a little apartment somewhere and just say, well, just forget about them. And we don't help our own people. I don't understand it.
Well, it is. It has to do with these big picture things. Well, you and I, we don't see big pictures necessarily. We see our neighbors, we see our neighborhoods, we see job loss, we see deterioration of the infrastructure. And these guys that are in charge, the political elites operating at the behest of the financial elites, think, well, we have to have this strategic alliance to do this and that. Well, they're in charge. We're not. So that's why that winds up getting done on their terms instead of ours. And we just just turn out to be kind of like, you know, cannon fodder to them for the wars that they start unnecessarily. And, you know, we work our butts off, and then they take some of our money and they send it to foreign militaries. Doesn't make a bit of sense to me either. All right, Paul, thank you very much. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, we will be right back.
You're listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Are you that one in a million salesperson that always gets client meetings that no one else can ever seem to get?
Do you get in front of real decision makers no matter what it takes?
Are they impressed with you?
Can you close a deal without hesitation?
We are Greater Media, a privately owned company that owns this radio station and many others. We're looking for those special people who can develop the right relationships with the right customers and bring them great ideas. Working for us, you can turn your ability to get great ideas in front of real decision makers into closing deals and making high commission fast. Just go to iclosedeals.net. That's iclosedeals.net. Tell us a bit about yourself. That's iclosedeals.net, and we'll talk soon.
I'm going to let you in on a secret. Club 11 Bar has the best food in Macomb County. Have the late-night munchies? Then check out Club 11 off of 696 Service Drive in Roseville between Gratiot and Grosbeck. Over 77 great items on their top-notch menu, including breakfast anytime. You can get served food at Club 11 till 2 a.m. So what are you waiting for? Go right now. Club 11 Bar, Roseville's hidden secret. Look for them on the 696 Service Drive between Gratiot and Grosbeck.
Mid-Michigan, if you've had credit problems and you're in need of an auto loan, Lasco Ford and Fenton has good news. You're approved. Right now, you can go to LascoFord.com and get pre-approved. And if Lasco Ford can't get you an auto loan, they'll pay you $1,000 cash. Lasco Ford has the national lenders that will give you an auto loan at an affordable payment, like a 2007 Ford Fusion for only $149 a month. Lasco Ford also has programs for customers that may have had foreclosures, loan modifications, or repossessions in the past. And this month at Lasco Ford, you can choose from zero down or deferred payments up to 6 months. If you've had credit problems or have been turned down by another dealer, call Lasco Ford today and get approved. If you're turned down, they'll pay you $1,000 cash. You can visit www.lascoford.com to get pre-approved 24 hours a day at Lasco Ford. Open until 8 p.m. weekdays, Saturdays 9 to 5, or visit LascoFord.com.
Hi, this is Elmo from Sesame Street. And Elmo's here with the governor.
Hello, I'm Governor Jennifer Granholm.
Oh, and Elmo and the governor are here to tell you how to stay healthy this flu season.
First, sneeze into the bend of your arm.
Yes, always wash your hands really well.
And remember to have a plan ready in case your child is too sick for school, so someone can stay home with them while they get healthy.
Stay healthy, Michigan.
Sponsored by the Michigan Department of Community Health and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.
For some of us, gambling can make us lose more than a few dollars. We may lose our jobs, lose our homes, and slowly but surely we'll lose the people we love. We're at a loss as to why we can't control our gambling. We lose years struggling with an addiction we didn't even know we had. For free confidential help, call the Michigan Problem Gambling Helpline to speak with a counselor. Call 1-800-270-7117. It's time to win your life back. Sponsored by the Michigan Department of Community Health and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.
Hi, I'm Adam Helfman from HireItDone.com. If you need an honest contractor, visit HireItDone.com. My pre-screen contractors are ready to work for you. Now's the time to get an energy audit for your home. Get insulation blown into your attic and get your furnace tuned up by one of our five-star contractors. Maybe you want a roof that doesn't leak, or perhaps you just want an honest, trustworthy handyman. Remember, people aren't moving, they're improving. Your home is still your most important asset, and the best job is the one that's done right. Check out my pre-screen contractors. Log on to HireItDone.com.
Hey, everyone, it's Meltdown. Listen up. From time to time, you hear me talking about jumpstarting Michigan. Well, it always seems to come down to jobs and putting people to work. That's why I want to talk to you about an amazing place called the Stotzenberger Institute. They're a cutting-edge educational facility training people in high-demand careers such as personal fitness training. Hey, if you like sports, this is the career for you. They also offer massage therapy. therapy, and programs in the hugely expanding medical field. They provide lifetime job placement assistance, financial aid to those who qualify, and their programs are approved for assistance through Michigan Works. Look, if you're frustrated in your current job or need retraining to get back into the workforce, the place to get you started in the right direction is the Sotzenberger Institute. Classes start April 10th in their new state-of-the-art facility in Allen Park. Visit SITODAY.com. Again, that's SITODAY.com for the Sotzenberger Institute.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our final segment for tonight. And our phone number?
313-298-9743. Did you say we have open lines?
We have open lines.
We have the open lines.
Here's the latest on this raids on the Christian militia group. At least seven people, including some from Michigan, have been arrested in raids by FBI-led Joint Terrorism Task Force in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana. It's part of an investigation into the Adrian-based Christian militia group. The suspects are expected to make an initial appearance in U.S. District Court in Detroit today, which is Monday. And the second day of raids around southeastern Michigan, connected to a militia group known as the Huttery, or something like that. Mm-hmm. An Adrian-based group whose members describe themselves as Christian soldiers preparing for the arrival and battle with the Antichrist. I mean, isn't like the Antichrist like some supernatural dude?
Right.
How can you have a militia fighting like a supernatural dude? You got to have like another supernatural dude, the Christ. So they're gonna duke it out, and the whole deal is. I mean, I've seen the book. I didn't see the movie. What was his name? What was the guy that did the movie, The Passion of Christ?
Mel Gibson.
Oh, Mel Gibson. Yeah. So I didn't. Actually, that doesn't have final days.
Not like him.
But. So it all comes out all right in the end. So these guys, I don't know why they're running around with illegal weapons.
Did you see that movie?
No.
No, me neither.
Oh, man.
That's no way.
Yeah.
I remember, well, I was married at the time, and mother-in-law was very religious, and she looked at me and she said, "Oh, Julene, you must see The Passion."
I mean, it was like,
no, it's like 3 to 4 hours long.
They're torturing this guy.
Yeah, why would, no. I will not ever see it.
Well, at the beginning of the show, we were talking about this new Harris poll that revealed the Obama derangement syndrome, ODS, and that's what is described by author John Avlon as a pathological hatred of President Obama posing as patriotism. Now, and we said 2/3 of Republicans think that he's a socialist, which that's a matter of opinion. Okay, that I have no argument with. I don't agree with that. I don't think.
I think that's a big eye roller. All of it's just a big eye roller.
Yeah, well, they don't know what a socialist is.
Right.
So, or they have their opinion.
It's their
version, their
idea of what a socialist is.
But it's okay.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, it's their opinion, so we'll let that go. But 57% of Republicans, these aren't teabaggers. These are like your ordinary, maybe all Republicans now are teabaggers. I don't know. 57% think he's a Muslim. Now, where in the world would somebody call that thinks he's a Muslim and tell me where they get the idea from?
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Well, his father was born
in Kenya.
In Kenya. Yeah. So they.
Let's see. So they agree with the birth. 38% of Republicans say that Obama is, quote, doing many, many of the things that Hitler did.
Give me one.
Maybe two. One, they can say, oh, you know, health care. I don't think Hitler. Any health care. Actually, there was health care. There was that kind of social programs that began in Germany under Bismarck, like in the 1880s or something like that. 24% of Republicans say that Obama may be the Antichrist.
This is just complete insanity.
Yeah, it is.
People are nuts.
Actually, these numbers all come from a brand new Harris poll inspired in part by my book, but John Avlon's book called Wing Nuts, How the Lunatic Fringe is Hijacking America. You know what? They're not hijacking America. They are, they're like, I guess it's not an appropriate book anymore, but it's like this children's book where the character got this tiger to run around and just chasing it and finally turned into butter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was Sambo.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
But it's not politically correct anymore. I thought that was a charming little story. Probably.
That was a little restaurant, too. They had to get rid of those. Remember Sambo's restaurant?
Really?
Back home in Iowa, we had a Sambo's.
But anyway, if you think about it, the main thing that these teabaggers want to do is, they're really radical, get Republicans into office.
Well, I think they're just going about everything all the wrong way. This week they're throwing bricks in Democratic Party offices. Now, and their defense, we're not throwing them at the congressional offices. We're just going to the Democratic Party offices. Okay.
Is that right, what they said?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, the blogger.
So does anybody want to come on the air? I won't say that you have the Obama derangement syndrome, but it says, you can tell me. I don't even know. Listen, let me give this inducement. If you will cop to any of this stuff, that you think that Barack Obama is a socialist, if you think he's a Muslim, that if you think that he's doing many of the things that Hitler did, or if you think he's the Antichrist, I promise you that
you won't hang up?
I won't hang up and I won't argue with you. I just want to hear your reasons.
You won't? You've tried this before, Peter.
Yeah, sometimes I lie. Oh, am I on the air?
You promise to really try.
I'll try. Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Here's Marcus and Warren. Hi, Marcus. You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
I apologize. I'm a bit nervous. I apologize.
That's okay.
No need to be nervous.
I wanted to talk to you guys. You had a caller earlier, and he made a comment that kind of it made me laugh a little bit.
What's that?
Give me back that fish. Give me that fish.
What are you, Becca?
What was that? Do you know?
I don't get it.
I don't get it either. What was it?
Yeah. Here's Martin in Detroit. Martin, you're on the air.
That was the whole show.
313-298-WRIF. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I had a just recalled a few minutes ago that I had some contact with some students at a local community college years ago, around 1996, roughly speaking, who showed me a catalog of videos that was being distributed by the Adrian Christian Underground.
Wow, could have been these guys. Huh?
I think so. And what was interesting is that later on, this is the time when the militia movement was using shortwave radio as a medium of communication.
Yeah.
And a woman in Indiana got really outraged at this group by name for, you know, copying her videos and selling them.
Huh. Well, I'll tell you, I went to the group's website, and they have some videos on there, and one of the things they had was they had something like the largest automatic weapons discharge in the world, and they had this huge bonfire, and they're all shooting these automatic weapons, and it's sort of a guy thing, you know. Actually, you know, when I go out to the rifle range, I don't know. I hate loud noises, you know, so I can wear like earplugs and all that, but I mean, these guys like that. I mean, they, you know, they like big fires.
It wasn't too long after that, Peter, that an employee lounge at a certain community college, I had a long conversation with a guy about the militia movement, and I kind of yanked him away from it a bit, but that was quite a conversation.
I can imagine. Well, thank you, Martin. I appreciate your call.
You're welcome
for joining us.
Look, Peter, you must have inflamed someone because the phones are ringing off the hook.
Well, maybe there's somebody who's going to tell us.
You
that they
promised
believe.
Not to argue. I think that's what it was.
Just when my voice is, you know, suddenly I'm beginning to feel okay.
Feeling great. Yeah.
Yeah. Come on. Bring it on. Here's Bernard in Detroit. Bernard, hi. It's Peter and Jeline. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is Renard.
Hi, Renard.
All right,
sorry. Well, the thing about Saddam Hussein was that he never came to Detroit, but he did give the money to the church. I mean, to, you know, it wasn't directly to Detroit, and that was in 1979.
Okay.
And when that was the thing when they gave the money to that was in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
When the people mover was made, I'm sorry. When the people mover was made, that was in 1980, and when the money was given in to by Saddam Hussein was in 2003, so it could no way that
not 2003.
The mayor.
No, they 2003 is when the article was written, and they said a couple decades before that.
Understand what I'm saying? There's no way. The guy you said that Coleman Young was in office, and that's where he did with the money made the people mover.
Cool. We got a train to nowhere. All right. Thank you, Renard. I appreciate that. Let's see. Here's Roger in Trenton. Hi, Roger.
Hey, Roger. What's going on, Pete?
How you doing, man?
Good. How are you, sir?
Good.
What I would like for you to tell me is how Barack is not a socialist.
No, I want you to tell me how Barack Obama is a socialist.
Yeah, see, that was how it's supposed to go here.
He is a socialist right off the bat from uniform health care.
From
what? I mean, okay. That proves it.
That's a socialist subject. That is how it's played. Tell me how. Hello.
Hello, I'm listening.
Okay. All right. In Canada and all these other countries, like, you know, they have uniform health care and all this other BS. And you know what? If you're sick in Canada, what do the Canadians do? They come to America.
Well, here we go again.
Now, wait a minute. You're going. They don't come to America. They go to their local health clinic, and they get free health care, and they're pretty happy with it. Okay, so...
We get that a lot of you really believe that. We don't.
Okay. Let's see. Here is... okay. General conversation. Here's John in Ann Arbor. John, hi. You're on the air.
Hello, Pete.
Hi.
Jolene?
Yes?
Good evening. I just have one question for the teabaggers.
Yeah.
You know, as I recall, when George Bush the second took office, there was a budget surplus.
Yeah.
And between all these misguided war policies and, you know, tax cuts for the wealthy, suddenly, there's this big gaping deficit. Where were these people?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was George Bush that first initiated the big bailout of Wall Street. They didn't say a word.
Well, this is what troubles me. I mean, you know, I'll give away my political leanings. Obviously, I agree with you. But, you know, this has been going on for 8 years. Where were these people?
Yeah, no, it's about Barack Obama. I don't know if you heard me earlier, and Jolene was making the same point, that there's this article in the New York Times. Actually, go to my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, and the article is entitled, It's Not About Healthcare, and it tells about where the hysteria and the fear and the insane reaction to all of this is really coming from.
Yeah, highly recommend that.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. So what I'm looking for are people that, here it is. 57% of Republicans believe that Obama is a Muslim. 45% of Republicans think he wasn't born in this country. 38% of Republicans say that Obama is doing many of the things that Hitler did. And 24% of Republicans say that Obama may be the Antichrist.
So
two-thirds think he's a socialist. So I'm making you the offer. You can just lay this out. You can just lay this out. Maybe this is one. People, and I'm not going to answer. I'm not going to, I won't argue with you, I promise. Here's Jim in Flint. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Jim, now, usually, you know, I say one thing, you say the one thing.
What's on your mind?
Yeah. Jim. Wow.
I think his phone is... I don't know. That was very strange.
I think it's called stage fright. let's see here. Here's Dominic in Westland. Hi, Dominic. You're on the air.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
I was just calling to let you know that song that guy is singing.
Oh.
What is it?
It's the McDonald's Filet-O-Fish commercial song.
What does it mean?
Sing it for us again. What did he say?
I don't know the word. It's something about give me back my Filet-O-Fish. If you guys look up on YouTube, there's like a robotic fish on the wall, like where you hit the button and they talk.
Oh, I've seen
And the
those.
Guy's eating the double fillet of fish for McDonald's,
oh,
and his
God.
Fish starts singing it, wanting it back.
Thank you for clearing that up, because I just had no clue.
Yeah, you know, why are we doing that? We should do a morning show. Thank
we
you, Dominic.
We can talk about things
that. We would love to do a morning show,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah, sure.
Except that we got too good a one here, though.
Yeah.
Here's Kevin and Warren. Kevin, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how's it going?
It's going well. Good.
Yeah, you wanted to know how our president is a socialist. First of all, first and foremost, the one thing that he has been talking about for so long is this great redistribution of wealth that he would like to do, whether it be through taxes or through this whole health care thing. And, you know, it just gets me that, you know, a lot of it comes down to common sense. There's no common sense in politics anymore, none whatsoever. But that's not my point. I'm getting off the point here. You know, he wants to redistribute wealth, like I already said. We've got health care, which is government take over everything. Government now owns 51% of our economy. If that's not socialism, I don't know what is. They own the auto companies. They own the banks. Now they're getting involved in health care.
What about some
all
of
this stuff that they're doing, and...
All right.
You know, where's it stop?
All right. Let's establish that. How about some of the other things? Do you think he's the Antichrist?
No, I do not.
I'm
not a Republican. I'm a conservative, and there's a big difference.
Yeah.
Do you think he's a Muslim?
I do not believe he's the Antichrist. I do not believe he's a Muslim.
Okay.
Right. I mean, anybody who's got a brain would know that.
You know, by the way, let me just...
Well, there's a whole lot of people without brains.
To some extent, here the New York Times agrees with you. In the health bill, Obama attacks wealth inequality. For all the political and economic uncertainties about health reform, at least one thing seems clear. The bill that President Obama signed on Tuesday is the federal government's biggest attack on economic inequality since inequality began rising more than three decades ago. Over most of that period, government policy and market forces have been moving in the same direction, both increasing inequality, which means the rich getting richer, and the middle class and the working class, well, here it says, the pre-tax incomes of the wealthy have soared since the late 1970s. This is a result of Reaganomics, while their tax rates have fallen more than the rates for the middle class and the poor. So the middle class and the poor are getting screwed. The wealthy are privileged. Nearly every major aspect of the health bill pushes in the other direction. This fact helps explain why Mr. Obama is willing to spend so much political capital on the issue. So, in that sense, I would say you're correct. I don't know if that makes him a socialist, but if it does, so be
it. In your mind?
I agree with him.
Okay.
All right. So I wasn't arguing with him. Oh, here. Let's see. Here is Ron and Warren. Ron, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, you know why a lot of these people believe that Barack Obama is the Antichrist? It has to do a lot with this Mayan calendar ending in 2012. And I think a lot of people buy into that, you know, through the prophecies of the Bible and things like that, that show that, you know, the end of times is near. You know, so, I mean, you know, a lot of people buy into it. Not that I necessarily do, but, you know, I think a lot of people do believe in that, because a lot of those people that are Republicans are really religious.
Yeah, well, they are. But how about this, Ron? How about this scenario? 2012 comes, the year it all ends. And what happens in 2012? Pardon me. There's a presidential election. And guess who gets elected? Sarah Palin.
Sarah Palin is the Antichrist.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Let's see. Here's Chris in Macomb. Chris, how are you on the air?
I've been listening to you guys for a while. Actually, a recent college grad. I graduated in August.
How much do you owe?
I owe about $20,000.
No, man.
Uh-huh.
Hey, by the way, let me just tell you this. I am interviewing somebody on Wednesday that I'm going to play on...
Next week,
which is going to be all about student loans and why in the hell university education shouldn't be free. But I guess it's a little too late for you. But congratulations anyways, Chris.
Yeah, I know. I've been searching for a job for the past 8 months because I lost my work study program with my university.
Wow.
So the whole healthcare thing is big for me because I can't be on my parents' health insurance anymore because I'm over age. So,
How old are you?
I'm 24.
Hey,
you're okay. They're extending it to 27.
Now they are, because the bill passed. So it was
right.
It was good for me, but
right.
I know a lot of people are complaining about it because the people who do have jobs right now, I can totally understand they have a job and they don't want to pay more because the economy is bad and they're trying to buy things.
Well, but it shouldn't, at least in the short run, it doesn't look like anybody's health care is going to go up. For one thing, this stuff doesn't even come in until 2014, so we can't even really see. I mean, most of the short-range things that are going to happen in this year will overwhelmingly benefit people. In the long run, what the hell is going to happen? It's just going to be played out. And if we begin to see that it has problems, that you can correct those things. But the idea is that we shouldn't live in a country where people like me can just walk in because I have health insurance and other people have to pay a fortune. Or, what do they say? There's like 44,000 deaths a year attributable to a lack of health care. I mean, that's outrageous. I got to get a couple more calls, so thank you for yours. Here's Jeremy in Flat Rock. Hey, Jeremy, you're on the air.
How you guys doing?
Good.
Doing just great. How are you?
Pretty good. I just wanted to tell you that your propaganda in your microphone will hurt more lives than all the concealed carry permit holders in the world.
What do you mean?
Just the lies and the one-sided opinions that you guys spew.
What did we lie about?
It makes me sick. So I want you guys to...
Don't hang up.
Give me back that fillet of fish. Just give me...
Wait, don't hang up. Don't hang up, Jeremy. Like what? Name a couple lies I've told.
Give me back that fillet of fish.
Come on, man.
Give me back that fish.
You can't come up with one.
He'd rather sing a McDonald's commercial. It's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
We take
it. Scott in St. Clair Shores. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
We're doing good.
Oh, that's great. I was just calling, wanted to say my opinion on health care, and I just...
Please.
I almost broke down in tears when he got it through and everything. I mean, I come from a family that we have our small business, and we don't have health care because we don't have enough people to, And I think it's really great because now me and my family, we all have, we're going to get health care soon, and just I'm really happy. And it makes me really sad when I see so many other people so against it and like having no real reason for it, because it seems like unless you make over, $80,000 or something like that, then you won't have to pay anything. And there's so many people that are against it, thinking that their taxes are going to go up, and so misinformed. And
well, that's what the Republicans have sold them such a bill of goods.
I know. And like when I see people like Glenn Beck or Bill O'Reilly, I watch a lot of Fox News just to see try to understand other people. And it just makes you really sad because they instill fear and they instill such misinformation and scare tactics. It makes me really sad.
There's no understanding these people.
Let me tell you this. This is just, it's up to you. It's your life. Life is short, as people always say. And every minute you're watching faux news, you could be reading a book. You could be...
Well, no, I do all that, too. I mean, I try to keep up on everything. Yeah. But, I listen to NPR, I watch CNN, I read articles, I read books. And, one thing I want to make a point, though, is that this hysteria with the health care isn't the first time in our country that nationalization of a
program.
Has gained such hysteria. Like in the early 1900s, they tried taking over the national government took over. The railroad systems.
Let me do this, Scott. Actually, I'm completely out of time, so I'm going to have to cut you short. But I agree with you completely. The right wing, the conservatives, went hysterical about Social Security. They did the same thing about Medicare. They're talking about socialism. It was going to destroy free enterprise, and they went absolutely crazy about the Civil Rights Bill of 1964 as well. These people have blocked everything that have made this country a decent place, and they're the problem. All right, thanks for being our last caller. Jalene Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Jade, thank you for answering those phones.
She had a long day. She started here at this radio station at like 6 a.m.
Oh, and she's also going to stay a little longer and make sure that we have a podcast up of this program by noon.
She's the woman.
The Iron Woman.
Yeah.
All right, we'll talk next week. Oh, hey, stay tuned for a couple of great interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Are you that one in a million salesperson that always gets client meetings that no one else can ever seem to get?
Do you get in front of real decision makers no matter what it takes?
Are they impressed with you?
Can you close a deal without hesitation?
We are Greater Media, a privately owned company that owns this radio station and many others. We're looking for those special people who can develop the right relationships with the right customers and bring them great ideas. Working for us, you can turn your ability to get great ideas in front of real decision makers into closing deals and making high commission fast. Just go to iclosedeals.net. That's iclosedeals.net. Tell us a bit about yourself. That's iclosedeals.net, and we'll talk soon.
Instead of going to some small smoky hole in the wall for dollar beers, why not go somewhere where they understand how hard it is for all of us right now, where you don't have to blow out your wallet to have a good time? Overtime Grill and Tap Room in Waterford has 17,000 square feet of action, starting with 4,000 square feet of gaming for you and your friends. With bowling, hoops, arcade, video games, you can catch all the sports action on the big screens and enjoy some of the area's best food. Overtime is ready to help you unwind with $3 bombs, $3 shots, and all your favorite trap beer specials Friday and Saturday nights. And Power Hour is back Thursday nights with $1 beers, $2 well drinks, and half off all wine.
Monday through Thursday, it's Overtime's world-famous triple play dinner for two. Appetizer, two dinner entrees, and dessert for only $19.99. That's right, just $19.99. Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, get a pitcher and a pizza for $10. Power Hour, Monday through Thursday nights with dollar drafts and $2 wells from 10:30 till 11:30.
The Overtime Grill and Tap Room in Waterford. Check out overtymegrillandtap.com.
24-month leases are back at Atchison Ford in Belleville. Atchison Ford, located just north of I-94 on Belleville Road. A short drive from anywhere. Visit Atchison Ford on the web at atchison.net.
Woohoo!
Win big at the casino?
Nope, better than that. I just got a great deal at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Ah, yes, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. The online connection to half off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses.
I always look there first. They're the best bet for online coupons and discounts.
This week, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com is featuring Roz and Friends Hair Salon in Troy.
Jackpot! Nobody beats MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Deal yourself a winning hand. Save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your own home when you connect to amazing deals like these and more at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Did you know that last year, smoking-related diseases killed 1 in 10 adults globally and nearly 500,000 people in the United States alone? How many times have you tried to quit smoking only to start back up again? How would you like to try an electronic smoking device for free that looks and tastes just like the real thing? Hi, I'm Dr. Richard Sandor for Smoke Assist, the revolutionary electronic smoking device that really satisfies. No tobacco, no smell, no tar, no stained teeth, no smelly clothes, and no more guilt. Live a healthy lifestyle for you and your loved ones. Now you can get Smoke Assist, $130 value for free. Improve your life today and be healthy. I'm so confident that Smoke Assist will work for you that I'm going to give it to you for free.
Get doctor-recommended Smoke Assist right now absolutely free. Call 1-800-428-0592. Get one for you or a friend. Call 1-800-428-0592. This is a limited-time free offer, so you must call now. 1-800-428-0592. That's 1-800-428-0592.
101 WRIF, NWRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Some of you who listen to others of my show may have heard me play this song called Doggone Shame. I'm trying to remember the words. They said, it's a shame the way the big boss plays the game. Yeah, I can remember it. They work you like a mule, treat you like a dog. It's a doggone shame. Well, working people in this country have always righteously complained over the generations. We've formed unions. We've passed laws. And at some point, the idea was that there was a not only a dignity to labor, but there that contained within it was the capacity for advancement in this society, that we could come in as immigrants or from a lower class and, quote, make something of ourselves. Is that still the case? Well, this is a very, very interesting book that's come my way challenges that notion. The book is called At the Altar of the bottom line, and you can imagine where it goes from there. At the altar of the bottom line, and the subtitle, very important, the degradation of work in the 21st century, the concept of work and its rewards being degraded. My guest, the author, is Tom Jurevich. He's a professor of labor studies at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's also an accomplished musician, and one of the things that this book features is a CD with some of Tom's work on it. He has a full CD with his singing. I'm going to ask him about that. I'm surprised his career isn't as a folk singer. He's the author of Commonwealth of Toil, Chapters in the History of Massachusetts Workers and Their Unions, and also edited The Future of Work in Massachusetts. Both of these, and including this book, are published by the University of Massachusetts Press. We joined Tom Jurevich at his office in Amherst. Tom, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you, Peter. Wonderful to be here.
And we should tell people that these are vignettes with hospital nurses, Guatemalan fish cutters, Verizon customer service reps, and also some laid-off factory workers. What's the genesis of the book? What gave you the idea to head into this direction in the first place?
Well, I think, Peter, I think we've all realized just how hard work has gotten. I mean, some of us are privileged to have jobs like radio hosts and college professors.
There you go, yeah.
But when we talk, when we walk around and we speak with our brother-in-law, the neighbor next door, person in the supermarket, things are getting tough at the workplace. People feel stressed. They're exhausted. They feel exploited. And some people feel abandoned. And so I felt that it was important for me not just to write about this from my own work experience or from the comfort of my office here at the University of Massachusetts. So I headed out into the real world of working people, and I spent about 5 years. I interviewed 85 people in these four workplaces, and the hardest thing for me was to stop. It was such incredibly vital work. I learned so much at people's kitchen tables, at diners, late at night, early in the afternoon, and it was just a fascinating story. But at the same time, chilling, of just how hard work has become.
Now, this is extraordinarily interesting because so many people, the authors, their work has been generated by the current crisis. So what we're talking about, the degradation of work in the 21st century, this is not something that you said, well, things aren't looking very good over the last year and a half. We're talking about a longer process.
Absolutely. It feels a little bit like, the lobster in the pot who doesn't always feel the water being turned up underneath them. American workers have been in a crucible really for the last 12 or 14 years. And each year things get harder, more stressful, more difficult, less secure. And in some ways, it hit its zenith, its nadir, with the economic meltdown last fall. But this was nothing new to working people, just how hard work has become.
I've worked as a journalist myself, and generally I would cover stories. So people were there, they wanted to express their point of view. But how does one get a whole sector of hospital nurses at a particular hospital, or these fish cutters at one place, and particularly Verizon, which you can't just waltz in there and say, look, I know you're screwing these guys. I want to get their views. What's the process here?
Well, in some ways, I was able to work through the unions that represented the workers at Verizon or in the medical center in New Bedford, where the Guatemalans, these are all undocumented workers. I was fortunate to work with a community activist who's worked with them for many, many, many years. But, it takes a lot of hard work and just determination to keep calling people, setting up times, and trying to make it all work.
Were they happy to talk to you?
Well, this was what's amazing. If you give people a chance to talk, and this isn't the 5 minute, stick a mic in your face. This is sitting down, a comfortable place, and talking for half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, sometimes two. And I think if you give people those opportunities, it's amazing how people open up. And I got told stories that you just wouldn't believe in terms of their own lives and their own work experience. So partly I think in our airwaves, we don't give working people an awful lot of chance to speak and to reflect. And it's not just that they're, colorful. I think that there's some really powerful reflections in their words.
Were they immediately open about how they felt about the negative aspects? Because your book is at the altar, the bottom line, and the altar means they're being sacrificed. And what occurs is the degradation of work in the 21st century. The subtitle of your book, because I know in Studs Terkel's book, Working, which I'm sure you've read, that at first they people say, "Oh yeah, great job, I love it," you know, and then by the end they're not quite as happy. Yeah.
That's right, Peter. You know, it takes people time to feel that comfort of the interview and settle in. But I also want to stress two other things here. I mean, it's true that people are really struggling at their work. But the other thing that, like Terkel, I think identified again here was just how much pride people want to take in their work. It wasn't as though people don't want to be doing these jobs, whether it's a nurses in the operating room or even Verizon call centers. Those women and men on the other side of that line, they really want to help you out. They want to help you out with the problem you're having with your cell phone or your landline. The problem is they're segmented into a situation where they have to use a formal script and can only answer certain questions, and they find that very frustrating. So the part of the frustration just doesn't come from they don't like their job. Part of the frustrations come from is that their employers aren't letting them do the job the way that they think they could best do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important. And I think the other thing that I also have to mention was just how hard people are working to make their lives possible for them and their kids. You know, people are working a job. One of the Guatemalans I interviewed worked two full-time jobs. He worked 80 hours a week for 2 years, was able to save $10,000 cash, and bought the first land his family in Guatemala has owned in three generations. You know, just people were really dedicated. So I think that those are also part of the story. Work is really hard, but boy, people are still digging in and trying to make it work for them and their families.
I always try to reflect what I suspect some listeners, at least, are thinking and would want me to question you. When you mention an illegal Guatemalan immigrant, I could imagine people thinking, 80 hours? Well, there goes two American jobs. Why the hell should I have any sympathy for him?
That's a really good question, Peter. And in New Bedford, where I did this research, is a really perfect example of what happened. Because many people say, yes, undocumented worker, they take these jobs away from Americans. But if you actually look at what happened in New Bedford, it's the opposite. Fish processing used to be a unionized industry in the 80s. In fact, if you took those wages now and adjusted them for inflation, they'd be making like $16 an hour. But what happened is this had nothing to do with immigration. It's that the fish processing companies, a lot like the meat packers, decided to deunionize the industry. And as working conditions and safety and health conditions deteriorated, no white person, if they could work anywhere else, would take any of these jobs. So in some ways, these jobs fell right out of the bottom of the labor market. And that's where the immigrants entered to fill that. So this is not a question about immigrants taking jobs away. It's about employers dropping the wages and conditions so bad that they're trying to get the most marginal worker possible. And in this case, it was some undocumented workers who stumbled into these positions.
And even though this one fellow was able to make the wages as an undocumented worker, that it's always not so sweet there, is it? I mean, you in your book, At the Altar of the Bottom Line, you talk about the conditions that they work under, not only the day-to-day conditions, but also the kind of protections that we would expect as American workers have just become so eroded.
Right. One of the big incidents in New Bedford was the company that actually had workers punch in for one company for 8 hours, and then they'd punch out and punch in to another company, go back to their same job station, so that the company wouldn't have to pay them overtime. They're cheated out of their wages. And the other thing I think the listeners need to remember is that as undocumented workers, they're not eligible for even Social Security. Tens of millions of dollars undocumented workers give to the Social Security system every year so that, Peter, you and I can have our Social Security when we retire.
Actually, it's hundreds of millions of dollars.
It
is.
They get nothing in return for that. And the same thing, many of these workers work also in some seasonal work, and the employers tell them, well, you know, work to December, then, you know, collect unemployment. Well, they can't get unemployment compensation.
Mm-hmm.
So before anybody jumps to the conclusion that somehow these are good jobs that leave people a good lives, I think we we need to remember that they have very little, they have no safety net under them. These are very difficult, brutal jobs.
Yeah, I wanted to just emphasize that point. I think we both made it, but let's say it again. The undocumented workers who are paying into these funds, like Social Security and workmen's compensation in the individual states, the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, get back absolutely nothing. They cannot, since their status is one of that's called illegal, they cannot withdraw. So the idea, you know, that somehow you see this floated around that they're sucking up the available funds just is not the case. Well, tell us though about the hospital nurses that you interviewed. You think, well, here's there's a shortage of nurses. You would think there'd be in a period where rather than being their conditions deteriorating or being degraded, that actually they would be in an upswing.
And this is the incredible paradox of nursing right now. So here's an industry where there is a shortage of nurses, and yet the working conditions get harder and harder. And I think we also have to speak about that shortage, because it's actually, if you look at the numbers, it's not true that there's a shortage of nurses, because in fact there are hundreds of thousands of nurses who have decided that they can no longer endure these situations and have dropped out of the profession. So what the nursing shortage really says is that there's a shortage of women and men who are willing to work under the conditions that now modern hospitals require of them. And it's amazing to me to watch. I interviewed workers in an operating room, and one of the women I interviewed, senior, 25 years of experience in the operating room. This is the kind of person you want doing your surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But what's amazing is that not only does she rarely have a lunch hour or breaks, oftentimes mandatory overtime, but she's required to work weekends and 12-hour shifts. Another nurse describes for me what it's like working 12 hours and what your body goes through during that and how you begin to fantasize about your sheets and your bed. And this is not the way to run an institution if you're trying to attract employees.
I worry, too, about my body. When you start having people, when you're, if they're caring for you in their 12th hour of their 72-hour week.
Yeah. And the evidence is really clear. Mistake rate, the injury rate, the accident rate goes up. And what's ironic is one nurse told me, there's regulations about how long people can drive trucks. And there should be, of course. But there's no regulations on how long I can work. And so what we see here is nurses working long hours, then they get sick, and then other nurses have to fill in for them, and then they get sick, and it's this long, vicious cycle by which everything keeps getting harder and harder and harder. And Boston Medical, where I did my research, I don't think is different than many major hospitals. It's just they've not been able to solve this problem.
And that's a well-respected hospital.
It's a very well-respected hospital, and these are really dedicated nurses. And the other problem there, too, is that the nurses really care about their patients. They're not walking out after 8 hours. They're not leaving their stations unattended. They passionately care about people, but at a certain point, they can only bear so much. And this has really changed. Partly what happened at Boston Medical is there was a merger of several smaller hospitals, and this is what's happened in the medical profession, is that on smaller hospitals, people had more flexibility. There was a bit more downtime, and now in these big, new, multi-merged hospitals under corporate power now, mergers, they just have very little flexibility, and I'm concerned, as many people are, about the long-term implications of this on our health as Americans and on nurses.
Tom Jurevich is my guest on the Peter Werby Show, and his book is called At the Altar of the Bottom Line, The Degradation of Work in the 21st Century. And Tom is a professor of labor studies at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And also, from what I've heard of, in fact, I shouldn't say of what I heard, I've heard your entire CD, part of which is accompanied as a CD with the book. You're an accomplished, what we call, folk singer, right? Or, I mean, I'd have to be the judge of that. I would say you're an accomplished folk singer. You would say, modestly, you're a singer, right? Singer-songwriter.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, actually, I do this for a living. You certainly sound of a professional quality. Have you ever worked as a folk singer?
I have. I have most of my adult life. I sing less and more depending on, years and my schedule and research and so on. But it has been a big part of my life, and this gave me a wonderful opportunity because these interviews were not just rich enough for this book, but for songs. So a Verizon call center worker one afternoon says to me, we're speaking about her difficulty of her job and how hard it is, and she pushes back in her chair and she says, you know, when we were kids, none of us wanted to work for the phone company. We wanted to be nurses and teachers. And she says, I look around this place, and it's nothing more than a factory of broken dreams.
Wow. So you have a song called that.
Well, as a songwriter, I could hardly let a gem like that, yeah, a seed like that, fall on hard ground. So I took that idea and wrote a song called Factory of Broken Dreams based on that interview and those thoughts of hers. So there was beautiful, wonderful material to work with, and I feel just so privileged to be able to have told these stories in two ways, not just in the text, but in the songs as well.
Mm-hmm. And Tom has a website that's in construction, but there's material on it now. It's Tom and Jurevich is JURAVICH.com. You go to peterwerby.com as well, and there'll be a link there, and there'll be increasing amounts. See, I'm making work for you here. There'll be an increasing amount of material on there. Now, many of the songs are certainly pro-union, and two of these, the places where you interviewed workers, you've said were unions, the Verizon.
You're correct, yes.
Okay. What about the hospital nurses? Because that's been a big area of confrontation and contention around the attempt of nurses to unionize.
Yeah. No, they are unionized, and they have a pretty good contract in there. As I say, this is not the worst of hospitals indeed to work in as a nurse, but I think the thing what we've really seen is the battleground in nursing right now are on, you know, some staffing minimums, and you've got places like California who said, with this many patients, you need this many nurses, and that's made an enormous difference in both the quality of care and the lives of nurses, and I think that's the real agenda that's happening in healthcare right now is to set some safe staffing minimums so that these nurses aren't pushed quite so far to the edge.
Now, you're a professor of labor studies, and you can usually go two ways with them. I know, like, if I remember, a friend of mine was a prof at Ithaca. Is that the school, Ithaca? No. What's the...
Yeah, there's a big Cornell ILR school.
Cornell. Yeah, he was at Cornell. And many of the labor professors, of course, were oriented towards companies. In fact, talked about, labor management issues, which essentially meant how do we manage the workers. You seem to be coming distinctly from another direction, and that is pro-worker, pro-union. You can tell that, if not by the book, certainly by your CD and the songs that you sing. Many people say, and I get that all the time in the talk shows that I do, people say, well, the unions were good for my father or for my grandfather, and they helped us along, but now they're just kind of outmoded vestiges of the last century. How do you react to that?
Well, I think the thing, if we take a little longer view of history than that, I think what we realize is that, I mean, if we look at auto, for example, those jobs didn't start out as good jobs. They were terrible. They were as bad as any job I describe in this book. But it was through the labor movement that those bad jobs got made to be better jobs. And I think that dynamic is no different now than it was for my grandfather or my father or grandmother or mother as well. Right now, we've got a lot of jobs that are really very difficult, and the labor movement still has a lot of relevance into trying to create those jobs to be better ones. And we've seen some important new, I think, foundations built in the labor movement, some new organizing techniques, some new ways to approach. There's an awful lot more work to be done. But from what this book shows, I think we can't look to either Verizon or any individual employer to provide for employees even the way they did for my father's generation. These companies don't look like the big corporations that took care of their workers in some way, both in terms of pay and benefits and working conditions. They, in fact, look a lot like mom-and-pop firms or small firms on the margins. So in this case, we need the labor movement more than ever as a voice for American working people.
Well, I just ran into an old friend of mine who I was surprised that he said this, but it's not an uncommon view, and that part of the crisis, according to him, was created by the unions demanding too much compensation. In fact, you may have seen, I, when I say May, is because this was tucked away in like page 3 of the New York Times, in which these two writers averred that that American manufacturing workers were making 20% over what their productivity versus labor in other parts of the world were making, and that there really should be a 20% cut in wages across the board. So it's kind of two parts. One is that it's labor unions themselves that created the crises because of being overpaid, and I guess it's really one. And that to take your advice, Tom Jurich, Jurevich, I have a friend by that name. Actually, the same name would have pronounced just a little bit differently there, that this would add to the crisis.
Well, I think that, again, this is what we saw, for example, in the auto bailout. What was amazing was that in that auto bailout, workers were required to drop their wages and benefits to the level of the Japanese transplants. But what we didn't see in that agreement was any restriction on General Motors on management salaries or even to build, you know, more fuel-efficient cars. So it's always this blame pattern that blames down, always blames the workers. And for example, if you look in the European situation, what we saw is that when the financial crisis hit, the companies didn't go after the workers. They said they understand that people need to be fairly compensated. And the issue, I mean, frankly, during the crisis and still now in the automobile industry, General Motors workers could work for free, and it's not clear that the company would survive. So I think it's really a wrong thing to blame just the workers. I mean, we always blame this notion of workmanship when, you know, what happened in General Motors has an awful lot more to do with the design of cars, the marketing of vehicles, and all those things, which are not decisions that workers make. So I think it's a very convenient pattern in this society to blame downwards and to blame those workers. I mean, we need those high-wage jobs to drive this economy. And one of the things I say in the conclusion of this book is that, you know, we can't simply go to a low-wage economy. We need money in that system to be able to provide other workers with work. So we need to actually change this direction and start figuring out ways that we can increase workers' wages so that there's more disposable income and we can once again get this economy back on track.
Well, we only got a minute or two left, so I should leave mostly your opinions. I think, though, of a Latin American model for this country. I'm not advocating this, but is that capital circulates within a much, much smaller segment of the population than it had previously. And that is that maybe even as much as half or who knows, maybe even two-thirds, like in some Latin countries, are underwaged and they're really on, you know, in alternate economies where whereas maybe one-third of the population are the ones that have nice houses and buying cars and what have you, but that keeps the engine still going. You don't think it can go like that? I hope not.
I hope not, too, because, again, I think the situation is, you know, we have a different expectation about what our standards of living are in this country, and we also have a history here. You know, my father was a factory worker, and as a kid, you know, not only did we not go hungry, we had decent health care. We had all the things that a family needed, you know, if we take away steady jobs with decent benefits and working conditions that aren't so difficult that exhaust people beyond the pale every day, then it's really hard for us to envision the kind of society I think that we want to be. So I think we've got to restore some sense of dignity back in the workplace and some sense of moderate, decent compensation for the work that workers do. They want it and they deserve it.
Is it possible in 30 seconds to say, how do we turn that around? How do we turn around the degradation of work in the 21st century?
Yeah, quickly, two things. First off, I think we have to begin, as we've done here this afternoon, having this conversation. People are suffering these issues about work in the workplace and the privacy of their own homes, their kitchen tables. I think we've got to get this out and make this a public discussion, number one. And then secondly, I think we need to do an awful lot politically to make sure that firms are being rewarded to create jobs and keep jobs and give decent jobs and to move away from what began under the Bush and Clinton administration of giving companies the green light to go overseas to produce things elsewhere. So I think that there are some simple steps we can take, but we have to be really committed to the dignity of work and the importance of working people to this country.
I want to thank you so much. Tom Jurevich has been my guest. He's the author, At the Altar of the Bottom Line, The Degradation of Work in the 21st Century. It also contains a CD that has four songs by Tom and also some of the stories, some of the people he interviewed. Great photographs as well. You can go to his website, Tom Jurevich. It's JuraVich.com. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Tom Jurevich, thanks for being on my show.
Thank you. It's our pleasure, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Are you that one-in-a-million salesperson that always gets client meetings that no one else can ever seem to get?
Do you get in front of real decision-makers no matter what it takes?
Are they impressed with you?
Can you close a deal without hesitation?
We are Greater Media, a privately owned company that owns this radio station and many others. We're looking for those special people who can develop the right relationships with the right customers and bring them great ideas. Working for us, you can turn your ability to get great ideas in front of real decision makers into closing deals and making high commission fast. Just go to iclosedeals.net. That's iclosedeals.net. Tell us a bit about yourself. That's iclosedeals.net, and we'll talk soon.
It all starts with having a good pre-screened group of contractors to choose from, and Hire It Done is your one-stop guide to finding the one that's right for your home improvement project. Hi, I'm Adam Helfman, host of WRIF's Hire It Done. Before you start your day's home improvement tasks around your house, grab a cup of hot coffee and tune us in Saturday mornings from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Join us this weekend. Got mold? How about in your basement? We'll give you the who, what, where, and why on how to get rid of it. With the warmer weather just around the corner, we'll help you keep those cooling costs down. And what do your neighbors really think about your home from their point of view? What is curb appeal and why you might want to update your front yard? Plus, Carol Eberhardt from the Construction Education Trust sits down with us on the Contractor's Corner to discuss the new lead abatement regulations that are about to go into effect this month. If you're a contractor, you won't want to miss this. Hire It Done's money-saving tip of the week, our Green Minute, plus I'll take your house calls live. All this Saturday beginning at 7 a.m., on Hire It Done at 101 WRIF, The Riff.
Did you know that last year smoking-related diseases killed 1 in 10 adults globally and nearly 500,000 people in the United States alone? How many times have you tried to quit smoking only to start back up again? How would you like to try an electronic smoking device for free that looks and tastes just like the real thing? Hi, I'm Dr. Richard Sandor for Smoke Assist, the revolutionary electronic smoking device that really satisfies. No tobacco, no smell, no tar, no stained teeth, no smelly clothes, and no more guilt. Live a healthy lifestyle for you and your loved ones. Now you can get Smoke Assist, $130 value for free. Improve your life today and be healthy. I'm so confident that Smoke Assist will work for you that I'm going to give it to you for free.
Get doctor-recommended Smoke Assist right now absolutely free. Call 1-800-428-0592. Get one for you or a friend. Call 1-800-428-0592. This is a limited-time free offer, so you must call now. 1-800-428-0592. That's 1-800-428-0592.
Hi, this is Elmo from Sesame Street. And Elmo's here with the governor.
Hello, I'm Governor Jennifer Granholm.
Oh, and Elmo and the governor are here to tell you how to stay healthy this flu season.
First, sneeze into the bend of your arm.
Yes, always wash your hands really well.
And remember to have a plan ready in case your child is too sick for school so someone can stay home with them while they get healthy.
Stay healthy, Michigan.
Sponsored by the Michigan Department of Community Health and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.
For some of us, gambling can make us lose more than a few dollars. We may lose our jobs, lose our homes, and slowly but surely we'll lose the people we love. We're at a loss as to why we can't control our gambling. We lose years struggling with an addiction we didn't even know we had. For free confidential help, call the Michigan Problem Gambling Helpline to speak with a counselor. Call 1-800-270-7117. It's time to win your life back. Sponsored by the Michigan Department of Community Health and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. I suspect that probably the majority of you listening either were not alive during the late 60s and early 70s, or if you were, you were pretty young. But from so much history, so much you've seen in films, so much you've probably read about, it was an incredible decade, particularly the decade that goes from like 1960 to 1975, where politicians were being assassinated, student demonstrators were being shot down in the streets and at their colleges, police killed civil rights leaders. It was a decade of great turbulence, and people reacted to it in a variety of different ways. And we're fortunate now to have many of the people that were active during that time beginning to write memoirs about it, reflecting on it from as much as 40 years hence. And it's not just history, because it's also about us today as well, not just the journey of the person that is writing the memoir, but also how we as individuals fit into a particular historic period. Joining me right now is Kathy Wilkerson. She's written such a memoir. It's called Flying Close to the Sun. And Kathy Wilkerson was active in the civil rights movement and in the quintessential New Left student group of the era, Students for a Democratic Society, and then the group Weatherman. In 1970, she was one of two women to survive an explosion in the basement of her family's townhouse that killed three weathermen, and it forced her and the group to go underground. For the past 20 years, she's worked as a mathematics educator in the New York City schools. It's a pleasure to welcome Kathy Wilkerson to the Peter Werbe Show. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Maybe just expand. I know your book pretty much ends on this explosion in the townhouse, and it must be, even though you've written about it, you've probably described it any number of times, I'm sure it's probably still painful, but I think maybe that this might be a good jumping off spot. Bring us back to that day in 1970 in New York City.
Well, it was 1970, and while the movement had been the civil rights movement and the student movement and the anti-war movement and all kinds of movements had been very upbeat and optimistic during the late 50s and the 60s, by the late 60s, people had begun to be discouraged, because no matter how many hundreds of thousands of people we regularly turned out for demonstrations, the government ignored us and continued to escalate the war, draft more young men, kill more Vietnamese women and children, the busing crisis was happening around integrating the schools. So we had really kind of reached a crisis by the end of 1969. And for me, that crisis was epitomized by Fred Hampton, the leader of the Black Panther Party in Chicago, being killed in Chicago in December of 69.
Essentially assassinated, as I said.
Yes. Yeah. The police went in and fired, I don't remember how many, 30 shots into the apartment and barged in and shot him in the bed.
While he was drugged. He had been drugged,
yes.
by a CIA or by a police.
At a party, somebody had dropped something in his food. In any event, for me, that was like the last straw, and I had joined Weatherman, which was a group dedicated to fighting the government, basically, saying that if democracy doesn't work, then we have to take on the economic foundation underneath democracy that requires constant expansion and profit taking at the expense of our lives, and so in all kinds of ways. So we had turned, as absurd as it sounds now, we had turned to sort of starting up a symbolic warfare against the government, so that when they did all these horrible things, from killing Black Panthers to the war in Vietnam, they would have to at least pay a price. They would know they couldn't get away with it without any cost at all. And so we were, people by then had been doing Molotov cocktails all over the country on a regular basis against induction centers and Bank of America, which supported apartheid in South Africa, and other sort of corporate and military targets, and it had become almost routine. And by 1970, we thought, well, maybe it would be safer to build pipe bombs to do this. And other people had been doing it as well, but we didn't know what we were doing. And the bomb exploded in the basement and set off a box of dynamite that was next to it, and so brought down the whole house. And three people were killed, and two of us escaped the house as it burned to the ground. So it was a lesson not only to us, but I think to tens of thousands of other young people, that one ought to really think more clearly about this strategy before buying into it. Even though what we did succeed in doing was making the point about how profoundly outraged people were. And I think, and that's why we have become somewhat iconic in 60s lore, because so many people were that outraged, even though they didn't agree at all with what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
They were outraged and didn't feel like they had a voice of that outrage. So Weatherman came to sort of represent that split personality within us, that we're outraged at the injustice that we see around us and the doublespeak and the hypocrisy of the government's talk about democracy and their practice of something quite different. And on the one hand, and being outraged, and on the other hand, wanting to stop them. But nobody knew how to stop them. And so while they didn't agree with us, they understood why this happened. But after the accident, there was a marked decrease in that kind of activity, at least in ways that risked human life.
Well, I know, Kathy Wilkerson, that following that, that there was a commitment of your organization, the Weather Underground organization, to make sure that human life was not taken or people weren't harmed. It was just property damage at specific targets. Now, I saw the film Weather Underground, which I would highly recommend to people, and which you're in, if I remember correctly, right?
No, actually, there's a quick shot of me, but other than that, I just chose not to participate in it.
Okay, and how many bombings by the Weather Underground were there? Something like almost 20, wasn't it?
Something like that,
yeah.
Yes.
And yet, certainly nowadays, that qualifies as terrorism, and people would say that the Weather Underground organization was a terrorist organization. Would you accept that as a definition?
Terrorism has a technical definition, which means that you attempt to terrorize the population with random acts of violence. And that was never, even at our most extreme, that was never our intention, in the way that periods of history, different groups have used that, like the Algerians used that against the French colonizers in Algeria, where they attempted to make life unbearable for the colonizers so they would go away. Or you could look at today's Al-Qaeda as a terrorist, where they do attempt to wage war on populations. But I think, nonetheless, part of why I wrote the book is I think it has to be looked at very carefully. If you use the weapons of war, you use weapons that can kill people, whether it's bombs or guns or anything else, you can be as careful as you possibly can, but these are weapons whose purpose is to create damage to people and property. And so you always run the danger of doing that. And if, in fact, the bigger question is, should people of the world, ordinary, regular people, try to change the world by using the weapons that corporations use to stay in power, which is the weapon of war, or do we not want to use that weapon?
What do you think? Now, looking back.
Well, the title of the book is Flying Close to the Sun because it's a metaphor connected to the myth of Icarus, whose father built him wings, feathered wings that allowed him to fly, but the wings were made with wax, and if he flew too close to the sun, the wax would melt and he would fall to the ground and die. But he was so exhilarated when he was flying that he forgot to heed his father's words. And indeed, the wax melted. So, and I think that humankind's relationship to technology is like that, that since the invention of fire, we've been so enamored with our ability to invent technology that extends our power, that we have not been wary of what the backside of that technology is. And the weapons of war now, the technology is such that not only does it create hideous destruction in the present, but destruction that lasts for generations. And we see that in Vietnam now with Agent Orange and phosphorus that is still causing untold damage. And in Afghanistan now, the United States has used depleted uranium bombs, which will affect the reproductive systems of Afghani women for generations. So warfare is so hideous, and it's also so cheap now because weapons manufacturers have flooded the world with weapons and continue to do so, primarily from the United States. And so anybody can get a shoulder-fired missile pretty much anywhere in the world except the United States. Is this an activity we want to engage in, even in the name of peace and justice? I don't think it's even possible to conceive of it now the way that it looked in the 60s with all the wars of national liberation around the world, of countries fighting for independence from colonial and economic imperialism. I don't think it's possible now to even imagine fighting a war without the cost, no matter who wins, with the cost just being overwhelming. So I think in retrospect, using those weapons then was a distraction from all of our attempts to need to create really creative techniques to challenge the government, and also the need to do the hard work of being on the planning commission, the local planning commission in our community, so that we fight over zoning issues. We argue over whether environmentally sound materials will be used on public buildings. We make sure that there's adequate water and sewage facilities before we allow these huge developments from which the developers make a lot of money, but then we're stuck with water shortages. So it's that kind of activism, I think, that we have to return to, along with the demonstrations and the very creative actions that people come up with, unions to defend, to have control, have a voice, so that the people who work in the plants have a voice in how they're run and what's produced. All of that, I think, we need the full range of activism, but I don't think we can hope to win by using the weapons of big corporations who expand into other countries and, you know, mm-hmm. demand their oil or demand chromium or uranium the way that is going on now in Africa. So,
Kathy Wilkerson is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. Her memoir is Flying Close to the Sun, My Life and Times as a Weatherman. Remind us, Kathy, of where the name Weatherman came from.
Well, it was a line from a Bob Dylan song that, and it came from a conversation between two people at Kent State when people were trying to figure out about what to call the people had written a theoretical paper trying to understand how corporations in this country expand around the world and how it affects jobs and our lives here. And someone else was listening to a Bob Dylan record and writing down the words of the songs. And that line came along, you don't need a weatherman to see which way the wind blows, and it subsequently became the title of the paper.
Mm-hmm. And then, as we've said, the name of your organization, first above ground and then underground. The life of Weatherman, the underground organization, lasted how long?
It had a public presence for about 6 months in 1969, and then a couple months in 1970, and then it was underground until 1976. And then when the war ended, the war was really the basis on which everybody stayed together and stayed committed to fighting. When the war ended, and ended in a way that was very positive, that the Vietnamese were able to then begin the process of healing and rebuilding and deciding what in the world they wanted to do with their country now that they had the ability to do it, there was no reason for an underground clandestine organization to stay together, and so it just kind of fell apart because weathermen didn't all agree on the same things other than our passionate opposition to the war and our belief that paying attention to the issue of race in this country is of critical importance, and particularly the history of slavery and the legacy of the post-slavery era of literally apartheid in this country up until 1960 was very important and really defined a lot of issues of power in this country.
In your book, Flying Close to the Sun, you have a number of photographs of your early family life, and in your memoir you talk about that as well, but we're mostly talking about the most dramatic part of it, so far at least, and there's a wanted poster of you, Kathleen Wilkerson, wanted by the FBI, interstate flight, mob action, homicide, possession of dangerous instrument, consider dangerous. Did you see that while you were underground and see that, you know, that there's that photograph of you and your fingerprints? And did you think, is that me? Is that me, Kathy Wilkerson? Dangerous, mob action, homicide? What's that all about?
Well, I knew that the poster existed. I don't remember if I actually saw one. But the homicide charge was the charge from the explosion at the townhouse. So theoretically, they were charging me with the deaths of my three friends. They ended up not charging me with that, but charging me with possession of explosives. And the other charges on the wanted poster came from demonstrations in Chicago and Pittsburgh, mostly around the issue of the war and racism.
Mm-hmm. Should you at the time have been considered dangerous the way they characterized you?
Well, I don't think I was physically dangerous. I think I was. Maybe they meant politically dangerous.
No, I meant you would not have resisted arrest in an armed manner. Well, this is what they say. May have acquired firearms. Consider dangerous.
I did not consider myself dangerous in that respect at all.
Yeah. And you served time in jail or in prison?
Yes, I did. I pled guilty to the charge of possession of explosives since it was my parents' house. I was definitely guilty of it. And I pled guilty and received sort of the standard sentence at the time, which was 3 years in jail.
And you served that?
No, I only served a year. After a year, at that time, they had the ability to get out on good time.
If you took this section of Kathy Wilkerson's life out, it's your life would be pretty mainstream, right?
Yes, my life was and continues to be in some ways very mainstream. I was raised in a middle-class family in rural Connecticut, and my parents were Republican but not active politically, and they were people who believed in equity and in doing the right thing and trying to be a good person, and we went to church, and I went to the local public school and said the Pledge of Allegiance every day and sang three patriotic songs and said the Lord's Prayer, because that was before the Supreme Court's decision. And what stuck with me was with liberty and justice for all. And I was very moved by sort of the mythology of the frontier, which was a very big deal in pop culture during that time. I thought that there should be liberty and justice for all. And when I began to notice around me, as a young child of 10 and 11, that there wasn't liberty and justice for all, and I first noticed it in terms of the different treatment of black people to white people, even up in Connecticut, I asked my parents about it, and they said, yes, it wasn't right, but they didn't seem to like do anything about it. And I thought that, and that was upsetting to me. And so I continued to look for people who were willing to try to do something about it. And so it was a very mainstream existence. My mother was a teacher, and when she started to teach at a private school, she moved us all to the private school. But nothing changed. I continued to look for a group of people who understood the larger picture of what was happening in the world. And as a girl child, I was told then that I had three options. I could be a teacher or a nurse or a secretary. Those were sort of it. And so for me also, and I think for many girls and women, finding the movement and the struggle for justice was a chance to find new options for ourselves. And
you didn't want to be boxed in into those alternatives, but you have been a teacher for 20 years.
Yes, but I came to teaching later on my own terms, really fascinated by and challenged by the attempt to implement Brown v. Board of Education, because that was a tremendous victory of the civil rights movement, and then their ability to force the federal government to come into the South and enforce laws around equity and end Jim Crow laws and the voting laws that kept black people away from the polls. But we still have segregation in the schools. So even though it's no longer legal or accepted, which is a huge difference, we still need to figure out how to have equity. And we now understand, which we didn't understand so explicitly, or at least many of us didn't. I'm sure there were some people who did. In the 60s, that you have to, we need equity in the context of diversity. And we need to treasure and respect the different origins and histories among us at the same time as we look for equal access to social, economic, and political life. And that's challenging to do, and we don't know how to do that. And in particular, the history of the black community in this country is particular in the sense that because they were enslaved, brought over here as slaves, because they played such a critical economic role in the South, and then a critical military role during the Civil War, and then played again a critical role in leading the Civil Rights Movement, their voice of saying, look, you cannot come out of 100 years or 150 years of slavery and 100 years of lynching and turn around and everything's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's not okay. And this is a huge issue in the schools. And the tremendous strength of that history of the black movement and its ability to transform many of us who are white has not been, it doesn't have a presence in the schools often. And so it's very hard for kids to relate to school.
Well, Kathy Wilkerson, at the beginning, and we're almost out of time, at the beginning of our conversation, you were describing the 1960s and the attitudes that towards the end of the 1960s, there was the sense that we did not live in a democratic country, that the vast majority of people were opposed to the Vietnam War. There had been all sorts of demonstrations and every kind of imaginable opposition. And that's what set you and others into illegal actions against the government. If someone came to you today and said, hey, look, we're exactly at the same point. That everyone wants our troops out of Iraq, the vast majority of people do that. This is, no matter how we voted, how we demonstrated, this continues. And I'm going to do something that you folks did in the 1960s and 1970s. What would you say to them?
I would say back up. And if you want to express your anger, then find a more creative way to express your anger. And young people have been doing that. If you want to change things, then you have to continue to do the very hard work of changing people's minds and trying to get control on the local level, because I think getting engaged in the local issues and getting power on the local level and getting our own house in order so that we have a coherent history of governing ourselves at the local level, then we're in a position to take on the national level and really change the rules of economic engagement, because it's those rules of economic engagement that sort of mandate the foreign policy. And we can't change those by, you know, setting off a few armed devices.
Well, thank you so much, Kathy Wilkerson. The book, the memoir, is Flying Close to the Sun, My Life and Times as a Weatherman. You can go to 7stories.com. It's published by 7 Stories Press. And you can go to their website, or you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and I'll have a link there to the book as well. Kathy Wilkerson, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Are you that one in a million salesperson that always gets client meetings that no one else can ever seem to get?
Do you get in front of real decision makers no matter what it takes?
Are they impressed with you?
Can you close a deal without hesitation?
We are Greater Media, a privately owned company that owns this radio station and many others. We're looking for those special people who can develop the right relationships with the right customers and bring them great ideas. Working for us, you can turn your ability to get great ideas in front of real decision makers into closing deals and making high commission fast. Just go to iclosedeals.net. That's iclosedeals.net. Tell us a bit about yourself. That's iclosedeals.net, and we'll talk soon.
Woohoo!
Win big at the casino?
Nope, better than that. I just got a great deal at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Ah, yes, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, the online connection to half off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses.
I always look there first. They're the best bet for online coupons and discounts.
This week, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com is featuring Roz and Friends Hair Salon in Troy.
Jackpot! Nobody beats MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Deal yourself a winning hand. Save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your own home when you connect to amazing deals like these and more at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Mid-Michigan, if you've had credit problems and you're in need of an auto loan, Lasco Ford in Fenton has good news. You're approved. Right now, you can go to LascoFord.com and get pre-approved. And if Lasco Ford can't get you an auto loan, they'll pay you $1,000 cash. Lasco Ford has the national lenders that will give you an auto loan at an affordable payment, like a 2007 Ford Fusion for only $149 a month. Lasco Ford also has programs for customers that may have had foreclosures, loan modifications, or repossessions in the past. And this month at Lasco Ford, you can choose from zero down or deferred payments up to 6 months. If you've had credit problems or have been turned down by another dealer, call Lasco Ford today and get approved. If you're turned down, they'll pay you $1,000 cash. You can visit www.lascoford.com to get pre-approved 24 hours a day at Lasco Ford. Open until 8 p.m. weekdays, Saturdays 9 to 5, or visit lascoford.com.
United States 2010 census forms will be arriving by mail at homes this March. And if you've moved in with a friend, loved one, or relative due to circumstances beyond your control, we're counting on you to make sure you're counted as part of the household you're living with. The 2010 census provides benefits that really hit home, like job training and health care. And the 2010 census helps provide funding for better transportation and education. So please, take the time and make sure you're included on your family, friend, or loved one's 2010 census form when they fill it out. Because together, we can move forward when you're counted and it's sent back. United States 2010 Census. It's in our hands. Paid for by U.S. Census Bureau. For more information, please visit 2010census.gov. That's 2010census.gov.
Now that you are connected with the world,
download your free Riff BlackBerry app today. Everything that rocks. Worldwide. At WRIF.com.